Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Queer Quadrant, a podcast where we, two bisexual filmmakers, examine cinema in all its cultural contexts and explore why your favorite four quadrant blockbuster is maybe not as straight as you think it is.
The Silence of the Lambs is a feature film that was released in 1991. I don't want to waste any time. Let's just dive into it. I usually say some bullshit, but I think we are rearing and ready to go. I got nothing. No shenanigans planned today.
Wow. I mean, you say that now, but might be some shenanigans that crop up.
I got some fava beans cooking. I got some Chianti lined up for us. It's 10 a.m. and we're ready to bust out a wine.
I'm just glad you didn't kick it off with a Hopkins impression, because that's where I thought this was going, and I was a little nervous.
Closer, please.
No, stop.
Closer. I can't do it.
It's very specific.
I'm going to expose myself, but this morning while I was showering, while I was on a run, yesterday while I was just cleaning the house, I was trying to do a Lecter. It's really hard to do.
You were actually,
shockingly.
Really?
I wanted to get it down because it's like an iconic voice. So I was just like, ooh, quid pro quo, doctor. But I can't do it. No, I can't do it, Brooke.
I'm sorry.
Like, I could do Venom. I can do Venom this whole episode if you want.
I don't know if you can.
But I can't do Hannibal Lecter.
Listen. Impressions, I would say, are...
Quid pro quo, doctor.
Is that your Venom as?
No, that wasn't... I don't even know what that was.
Okay.
I'm off.
I shouldn't have brought up shenanigans in the first place.
You shouldn't have.
Clearly. Okay.
The Silence of the Lambs is a 1991 film directed by Jonathan Demme.
To keep with the flow here.
Yes.
Hi. I'm Brooke Solomon.
Jordan Gustafson.
And joining us today is comedian Avery Edison. Hello. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. I'm furious because you've kind of spoiled my take that was going to be that Silence of the Lambs is a sneaky origin story for Venom.
Oh. That was what we were building towards. That was the galaxy brain take.
Yeah, Buffalo Bill's skin suit is obviously like the early stages of someone trying to create a symbiote. Mm. And I think obviously after he's caught, spoiler alert, you know, maybe researchers from the FBI stumble on the skin suit and they're like, what if we did this but with goo? And what if it talked to you? And then,
I'm kind of obsessed with this.
I think
30
that
years later we get Venom. Obviously.
Actually tracks.
Tom Hardy would
100%
like do like story credit you and Tom Hardy for Venom 3. Let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm willing to.
It's going to tie into the Hannibal verse, universe that has not been cracked in a few years.
Venom, let there be Fannibals.
Let there be Fannibals. I'm just going to warn everyone, you know, proactively that like you will hear about the TV show NBC Hannibal on this episode.
As if they haven't heard about it in every,
and
other,
every
episode.
I was telling Jordan, I was like, look, this is a movie which has so much that we need to talk about, I'm just warning you that NBC Hannibal is going to come up and I cannot shy away from
I think we should just get this out of the way while we're here.
Okay.
Do you mind if I throw it on the table?
No.
Avery, please weigh in. Who do you think is the best Hannibal? Do you think
it's
Mads? Wow. Wow.
Avery.
It is Mads by a country mile.
Damn.
I love this.
Is the country mile made of human body parts?
It's a country mile. As you're walking down the mile, you turn around and you see like a weird Wendigo stalking you.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
like
that's, yes.
Yeah.
Cool.
No, it's Mads, then it's Brian Cox, then Hopkins.
Yeah.
Whoa, hot take.
Let's go.
I
love this.
I love this too. I think that I would actually say it's Mads as well. I don't know if that is blasphemy, but
I think that's a solid take.
I think that Hopkins,
there's three versions of Hannibal.
Exactly. Yeah. It's three very different takes. No one is doing an impression of someone else. So I feel like
technically, isn't there like, is it Hannibal Rising that has a different person?
Yeah.
Right. Who?
Yeah,
there's
like a young guy playing. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like a Nazi. It's the journey of. I was reading up on Hannibal. I was reading up on Hannibal.
As you do.
Hannibal verse.
It's like a Nazi. He goes from Nazi hunter to cannibal, and that's the movie. So seems great. No
notes.
That's
crazy.
Yeah, perfect.
Anyways, you were saying, sorry.
Was on some shit. Yeah, no, but it's three very different Hannibal performances. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I think that whereas Hopkins obviously has like Hannibal behind bars, very locked up, pun intended. Mm-hmm. Like Mads Mikkelsen had so much fun with like Hannibal hiding in plain
sight. I'm going to eat your brain sight, and flirt with you.
Yes.
I think Hopkins' performance is incredible until you see Hannibal, NBC's Hannibal. And then you're like, oh, this is what it should be. And Hopkins is just incredibly cartoonish. And like, yeah, it's just too much. Like, there's so much subtlety to Mads' performance, even as it is also the most outre performance any actor has ever given.
Yeah.
And then you watch, you know, Hopkins, and you're like, how is he still in prison when he has seemingly chewed through all the scenery around him? Like, no walls can hold those teeth. It is so diamonds. And it's wild that it's also like thought of as like this restrained, like you don't even see him for much of the movie, and he's like saying he's hiding in the shadows. Sure. And it's like, no, it's the he's biggest there. Performance yeah. in any movie ever. And it's great. Yes. And it's thrilling to watch. But I, you know, if this movie came out today, I don't know that he would or should get the Oscar.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. Okay.
I totally actually like understand where you're coming from.
I agree.
Especially when I have made the mistake of watching the films Hannibal and Red Dragon. Which I regret. And in that, he's just like off
bad.
The walls. Yes. It's those, crazy.
Are you saying those films aren't good?
They're not good.
Mm. Ooh, one of them directed by a very bad person.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other directed by kind of like my boy Ridley Scott, but he didn't. Yeah. He only delivers
really
post sometimes.
Gladiator also, which is weird.
I know.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott, I don't know. We can't talk about
no,
Ridley Scott
no, no,
this
no.
episode.
I would like to weigh in and say, I think this is my favorite version. I
yes.
prefer him in this. I have watched Hannibal as well. I love Mads. It's really like, I think it's like dependent on my mood, because if I'm looking for like flirty, sexy Hannibal who's going to like eat your brains and devour your emotions, it's Mads. And if I'm looking for like having a lot of fun, as you were saying, chewing the scenery, it's this one. But I do really love Brian Cox's in Manhunter, as we should say.
I think he's the scariest.
It's mm-hmm. yeah. And yeah. It's like, I think it's just because maybe Brian Cox is just such an intimidating person.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, even like recently watching the Succession season 3 trailer where he goes like, full fucking beast. I'm like, I'm still scared of you. Like, Jesus back. I'm sorry. And I think it's just like dependent on the films and the energy. But in the household where I grew up, my dad was so, I don't want to say scared. But he was scared.
I thought you were going to say, my dad was a Hannibal. Yeah.
So
psychiatrist, he ate people. So.
He is a psychologist.
Oh, okay.
So there's a one-to-one. But no, he was so... I grew up basically with the... It was instilled in me basically where he viewed Anthony Hopkins as like the scariest actor ever. Because like this movie, I think like traumatized him or like was very scary. And so like we never watched any Anthony Hopkins movies because he was like, that guy's unnerving. Like he is so scary. I like don't trust him. So when I saw this in my brain, I built up... This is the scariest man of all time. And then you come down the hallway and it's like this 5'6" guy and he's like, hello, Clarice. And I'm like, wait, what is going on here? But it's still scary.
It's this movie.
The buildup in your brain,
right.
I think, is different because this movie like tells you that it's going to be so scary, you know?
Yeah.
I think in preparation for this podcast, I re-listened to the Blank Check episode on Silence of the Lambs.
A very good episode.
Very, very good episode. And they talk about how Hannibal is the devil. Mm. And like the way the movie ends, like, okay, Buffalo Bill's caught, and so it's a minor victory, but you've got, you know, it reminds you, no, the devil is still among us and walking out there. And I think when you're watching the movie, you get that feeling.
Mm.
But if I try and think of which Hannibal is more like the devil in human form, it's got to be Mads.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
And
yeah.
Also, like, when you think of which Hannibal can, say, there's a scene where he's cooking and he needs to cut a potato in half by throwing it up in the air and then it falls onto a knife and perfectly falls into two pieces. And they're like, okay, we can just CGI that in, Mads, but why don't you just do one take to see if you get it? And he does it perfectly. Like, I don't know that Anthony Hopkins can do that.
No.
And that's my criteria.
That's such a Hannibal. Such a good God. Mad story. And then him being like, I used to be a juggler. It is what it is. He's insane.
He's so hot too. It's like, that's the thing with Hannibal. Like Hannibal, if we're saying he's the devil, it's like, the devil's going to be like hot and like try to like make you overwhelmed by that and not like want to be, you know what I mean, this Anthony Hopkins looking person. And he wants to entice you.
I kept focusing on this watch of Silence of the Lambs on Hannibal's, like, his thinning hair that he has, like, slicked back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, you can see, like, the individual light. It's like a cartoon of a person losing their hair.
Right.
And I was just thinking, like, if that was, if you put Mads' Hannibal inside Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal's body, he'd be furious at what is happening to his physical appearance, you know?
Yes, wow. Absolutely. I don't think Mads will ever. He's just going to age so gracefully.
Oh, I mean, he is aging, gracefully, aging gracefully, as we've seen. Yeah. Yes.
And I I'm never constantly worried about the one tweet I saw where someone said, oh, yeah, if you bump into Mads Mikkelsen in a bar and get a few drinks in him, he'll say some dark things about immigrants. I'm never constantly concerned about that.
No,
I'm
no.
hoping against hope that it's not true. Yeah.
Oh, you don't like to see it. I did not
allegedly,
know that.
Allegedly, just secondhand hearsay, all that stuff. Let's cover our bases. But
I think it's no. Yeah, I think
track.
The thing is, like, look, maybe in our internet culture, don't worship at the feet of celebrities because most are bad people.
Yeah.
I'm trying a new thing where I separate the art from the artist. And I'm going to see how that works out. But I mean, this is a movie. You have to do that.
Yes.
Well, that's a very good point. So, like, I'll talk about, I guess, like, this is a relation. It's like, Jonathan Demme is, like, my all-time favorite director. Mm-hmm. And I, like, worship at the feet that he walked. And I was texting you about this, Brooke. And it's, like, it's one of those things that I hadn't really had until sort of stumbling upon his filmography and really digging in, listening to interviews and everything, is, like, he kind of has the approach to filmmaking that I do for myself. And, like, how he, like, thinks about collaboration and thinks about, like, just basically how he views filmmaking feels so in line with my thoughts. And I, like, wished that I had, like, a moment to, like, ask him questions. Or, like, it's like when you see someone, you're like, wow, I would love to, like, just study under you for a while. And so with him, like, with this movie, I think it's a thing where it's, like, really love him. But some of the things that he said have not been good. And sort of, like, he had definitely, like, at the time, better intentions for this, but I don't think he necessarily understood the repercussions that this movie would have,
right?
And or, like, the damage that it did, or, like, necessarily had the, like, the conversation around this movie, which we'll dig into, and, like, its legacy, I think, is very flawed. And the way that he portrays Buffalo Bill and certain things, it's flawed. And, like, he never basically was like, I recognize that. But at the same time, then he makes Philadelphia. It's a nuanced conversation. But what I'm saying basically from that is, like, it's tricky. It's tricky with this movie and people.
Yeah.
He made Philadelphia in direct reaction to the response to the movie, right? And it's no, like, the whole separating the art from the artist thing. This is a movie you have to separate from itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything, like, I don't know, I'm, for listeners who don't know and can't tell from my voice, I'm a transgender woman. And there has been, I feel like, in some of, like, my social circles or film social circles, whatever, by trans women and trans people, an effort to sort of reclaim the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect it, but that does not track for me at all. I think the Buffalo Bill parts of this movie are just the worst. This film is a masterpiece, and then every now and then you get some of the worst shit about trans people that's ever been put on film.
Yeah.
And you truly do just have to separate it, because the rest of it is just so good.
Yeah.
It's just a very good film.
It's the ultimate text. It's like it's one of the greatest films ever made. Like, it's like every element is so precise and so well, like, script, score, acting, cinematography, production, like, every fucking element is so good. And then, as you're saying, Bill's on screen and you're like, fuck, this is not good, and it has not aged well. And then you think about, like, how this film did irrevocable damage for, like, years of representation of trans people in horror films and in films, and, like, comedy, like, people doing parodies of this, and, like, it's so bad, the damage that it could, because it was so big. Like, this is, like, one of the biggest movies ever made, you know?
I think it says something about the idea that bigotry, the way it has an effect on the art you make, in that every aspect of the film is so just well made. I'm gonna talk about the Blank Check podcast way too much, I think, but because they're just so good at analyzing film. But they talk about how this whole movie is like film school in a movie, right? And just every element you can learn something from. And it is exquisitely made. And then you get to like the scene where Buffalo Bill is putting on the makeup and doing the tuck and dancing. And it is just like, it's so just the blueprint and also the copy of every kind of like voyeuristic, like, look at these ugly trans women putting on makeup. Like, if you watched a documentary about trans women in the past 40 years, there would be some part where they're sitting at a mirror and putting lipstick on. And it's like, and it just immediately brings the movie back to this basic, like, not elevated filmmaking where it's just like doing the most obvious thing. And yeah, it just, it really illustrates how if you give in to those base urges of like bigotry and hatred, and you know, I think Demi was a sensitive man, a sensitive filmmaker, but yeah, you'll just end up just lowering yourself in every regard, including the art you make.
Yeah, it's so crazy. And I think like this movie, one of the things that it benefits from is that the Buffalo Bill storyline is sort of like isolated in its depiction from like the rest of the movie. So it's easier to sort of like cut it and be like, these parts of the movie are like amazing and we can study them and like it's so revolutionary, and then these parts of the movie are like really harmful. But yeah, it's so complicated, I think, in part because Demi was such a sensitive guy and was very much like, I did something bad with this movie and like I want to try to make it up to the community via Philadelphia. And like, yeah, it's like it speaks really well to separating the art from the artist, because I don't think that you can just throw Demi out wholesale at all and be like, he didn't understand what he was doing and like that's a bad thing. Like, no, he clearly tried to make reparations in a certain way. It sometimes you just have to admit that things are really complicated, and that's just how it is.
With like this movie too, it's like you read, like I watched with the commentary this watch, because we had seen this movie like a month ago together at the cemetery. And then
been great.
It was awesome.
Truly like life-changing. But like listening to the commentary, it's like you can hear so much of the intention that they had with like Clarice's portrayal in this, and how like they, like I don't know if you've heard the book, but like in the book, she's much more like, like your prototypical female protagonist, but in this they give her so much more agency and so much more independence, and like deviate her from like her paternal father in images. And like this one is about like her breaking free from that, whereas in the novel it's much more like her like being stuck in it, and like they give her so much more agency. And he talks about like how they really want to have like a modern like woman in the lead and like have these progressive themes. So it's like they had the intention with some stuff, but then you recognize just because it was with like one element of the camp doesn't mean that the whole thing has that like progressive edge to it.
Yeah.
And by, and but I haven't read the book, but by all reports, like the book is like worse than the movie, right? In terms of the trans stuff. Yeah. And like also in, I don't know if it's Manhunter or the one with Mason Verger, like his sister in the book has some weird trans stuff going on. And like, yeah, it seems like a thing Thomas Harris isn't great on, and a thing that Demi definitely improved. But also, obviously, you know, you have to bear in mind the time it was made. Like, yeah, it's, I don't think it was possible to do a perfect version of this book back then, both because of the roots of the book, of the, you know, the source material, and also just the time. And, you know, he did maybe the best job you could, like he was maybe the best guy to do it.
Yes.
But it's unfortunately just not possible to do well because of the very character that it is.
Yeah.
I think it's like, it's because it's not showy, because it's not so like in your face horror. Like if De Palma was doing this, I would be, as we've seen with a De Palma movie, it's would be very in your face and very upsetting to watch. And because it is Demi, I think there's like a lightness of touch where it makes it like a little less egregious than it would be, you know what I mean, where it's so not like shoving everything down your face. But
yeah, I also think it speaks a lot to sort of like you know, this is a good movie to look at representation as a whole, because from what, like, I understand, a lot of sort of like the resulting conversation and like the very like venomous stuff that came out of this film was Demi and co being like, we didn't actually realize that there was so little positive representation on screen that, like, by virtue of this simply being a successful movie, that it would end up driving the conversation for like years and years and years, because it's actually the only thing people had to reference.
It's, you know, you still see references to Buffalo Bill all the time in popular culture, on social media. Like, people love the "it puts a lotion on its skin," people love "would you fuck me, I'd fuck me." It's, you know, and removed from its context, like, I understand that. It's like, they're iconic lines, and also it's very funny. Like, I don't know, in the most recent series of High Maintenance, two of my favorite characters, we finally see them again after not seeing them for a while, and they've been distant with each other, but they end up in the back of a lift together and bond over just quoting Buffalo Bill to each other. And one part of me is like, oh, this fucking shit, I have to think about Buffalo Bill again today. Great. And the other part of me is like, no, it's very, very funny. Like, him saying, "Was she a great big fat person?" Very funny.
Wait,
That's a really good Ted Levine.
Is Ted Levine
impression
in here?
We should have known better than to have Jordan do impressions in room with
a comedian. Cool.
Yes. No, it's really like this. Every slice of this movie is very iconic in a very specific way. And so it's like, it's always going to be part of the conversation. It's always going to be the thing that people go back to and be like, this was so earth shattering. Like, this changed everything. As I think they say on the Blank Check episode, this is just like what procedural TV is.
Yeah. Right. They say it was the blueprint for X-Files, and then X-Files was the blueprint for television.
Everything. Yeah.
And you watch this and you just see every TV show in it.
Mm-hmm. Every pilot read, you're like, oh, this is from that. Like, it's there.
Exactly.
And
we're all reading pilots all the time.
Of course.
A very relatable thing to talk about.
But what I had a question for you, Avery, is like, did you have like your own personal journey with this movie? What's sort of your relationship with it? Because I feel like, as movies do, they change with you over time, and especially, you know, for you, I feel like does it have like a personal connection change? Like, how did that affect you?
So it came out in 91, so I was 3 when it came out, and I think a couple of years...
And you went to the theater and saw it.
I went to the theater, and immediately I was like, this is canceled. I feel like I have a memory from childhood when I was like maybe 5 years old, and we were still living with my dad at the time, and I am told that they had to put locks on my door because when everyone was asleep, I would just leave my room and wander around the house doing stuff that I shouldn't. And I have this memory of being like very, very young, creeping out of my door. My parents still being awake and watching some movie on TV. And I have such a distinct memory of looking at the TV, like there's that glow in the room, all the lights are off, and you've just got this tiny set in the corner, like glowing. And I remember seeing like Hannibal Lecter pulling off the face with the hair to reveal his own face. And then, like, I don't remember anything else. So maybe I screamed, or maybe just ran back to my room, who knows. So that was like my first taste of this movie. And then as I got older and would hear about this movie in popular culture, I would be like, was that what that was? And obviously, like, as a kid around that time, you see that poster everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very scary poster. No, thank you. And it's a beautiful image that is also just so scary, because you don't know what is going on.
It's haunting,
but it is scary.
Having never seen the movie, it's sort of one of those, like, when you would go to the VHS store, like when I would go to Blockbuster with my parents and I'd see it, and I would be like, I don't know what that movie's about. I know it's scary, but like, why is there a moth on this mouth? Like, what is going on with Jodie Foster? How is it a horror movie? Is she eating these bugs? What's going on? Why are there lambs involved?
And then there's like, I feel like it got mixed up with like the cover for Candyman as well, because there's like bugs on that and stuff. And so just all these scary movies meshing into one. And in the UK, we have this, our film rating system is done by the BBFC, the British Broadcasting Film Censorship, something.
Yeah.
And so they are like degrees are like U for universal, PG, 12, 15, 18. And the 18 one is like, it's 18, it's in a big red circle. It's like stamped on the front of the box. And as a child, you see that and you're like, that's either like sexy or scary. And I can tell from the vibe of this poster that this movie is scary as hell. And I want to see it and I don't want to see it. Yeah, I didn't see it until I went to university for film and then we were taught to watch it. And I was like, okay, yeah, this is pretty decent. And then when Hannibal started airing, I just was like, I should go back and watch Silence of the Lambs. And then like the first time I watched it again, like as a proper adult with a fully formed brain, I was like, oh, I have to watch this again immediately, like 10 times. Yes. Yeah, because it's just so good. But yeah, it's like, I feel like, obviously you have so few memories as a very small child. This film is one of the iconic memories of what it felt like to be young and powerless and scared as a kid. So yeah, I feel like it's been with me my whole life. Question mark. If that's not too cool.
Yeah, no, not at all. I think that it is a movie that like really sticks with you in whatever way that that is. I mean, I watched it, I think my mom is a big horror fan. So she showed this to me when I was in high school and I was like, ooh, it's so good.
Pump the brakes.
Yeah, I know, right? Because it's like, what?
Fourth movie you saw at the time?
Okay.
Fifth movie?
Thank you.
So Passion of the Christ.
Are you done?
Spirit, Are Seven you of Cimarron, Silence of the Lambs. Those are the three?
There was a couple movies that my mom showed me before I was going to go to film school. Capital F, capital S, film school. That she thought were important for me to see. I think Breakfast Club was in there. Pulp Fiction. And
she was like, if you're going to be going to film school, you should know what a film
yes.
is.
Yeah. You should know what a capital F film is.
When you walk into like a film person's room and you see a Seven poster or a Fight Club poster, you have to know what those movies are.
Yeah, exactly.
If someone says to you, you know what movies are, right? You need to have an answer that's not just it's long TV shows.
It has
small acts,
form, three acts, four, depends. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, but there were so many movies that I watched for the first time in college that were like the iconic film school movies, like Seven and like Fight Club. But I had seen Silence of the Lambs before, so I felt like I was at an advantage. But I studied it in two separate classes.
Wow,
like
really?
Alone, yeah. Like it's a great tool to use. I mean, I studied it in a screenwriting class, and I studied it in like a female film class. And it's like it's applicable in a bunch of different, you know, concepts. And I think that like, it obviously moves extremely well, and it's very watchable.
It's so quick. This thing is like firecrackers.
And it's like, I think that...
Should we shift into the Ringer Podcast Network's Rewatchables podcast? Oh. Do you want to do a quick Rewatchables in the middle of...
Super quick.
We're just going to...
Hey, guys. Built in.
We're going to break so this into different podcasts. We're just
1991. Yeah, exactly.
We'll just go all through all the podcasts, because I'm sure that every podcast has talked about this movie.
Why?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Exactly. Is this a popular movie?
Bit of blank check. Bit of Rewatchables, perfect.
Bit of, or I guess we did, Hollywood Handbook was off mic. We said very briefly this is a...
it's a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on Mucharissa.
There we
Doughboys will do in the middle when we start talking about what they eat.
The
you
fava
know, like
beans.
Eating the food.
Nice
we'll like rank the food. Yeah,
that's got to be a 5-4 curve.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Love talking to another podcaster, because usually we're embarrassing. Yeah.
All I do is listen to podcasts all day long and play Fortnite. So that's
love it. Yeah. The best way to be.
It's working out real well for me.
This is a super rewatchable movie. Jordan, when did you see this for the first time?
I don't even. It's one of those ones where
it's always been with you.
This film has always been with me.
There you go.
Proved evident on the pod, I usually am very good with remembering when and where I saw things, but with this one, I don't know. It's just I remember seeing it once and have just seen it a fucking million times since. It's like I'll rewatch that opening scene, I'll rewatch certain sequences, like I'll watch the ending where she's going through you know what I mean? It's just like impossible not to sometimes think about certain sequences. Of course, when I watched Hannibal, I was like, well, I guess I gotta rewatch Silence of the Lambs again. And then when I saw Manhunter for the first time a couple years ago, I was like, well, I guess I gotta rewatch Silence of the Lambs again. So it's just, I don't know, it's hard to not come back to it because it's just such an urtext. And I just love everyone involved. Like, I don't know. I have no notes.
Yeah, I mean, some notes.
I mean, sorry, notes, but for watchability, no notes.
No notes. I think it's interesting to look at the Hannibal Lecter universe, for lack of a better term.
The HLCU.
Yeah, the HLCU, the Hannibal Lecter Cinematic Universe, because as you mentioned briefly, Avery, the Thomas Harris books are kind of like really fucked up and like not great about a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I have, but I wouldn't consider myself like an expert. It's not like I've read every single one, but I've definitely...
You're not a Harris stan?
No, oh no, absolutely.
We go
not.
Into your home, they're like on bookshelves perfectly above your TV.
But I think the reason that like his writing is so like lends itself so well to this cinematic universe is one, because like the concept is amazing. Yeah. What if there was a cannibalistic serial killer who was also like a European gentleman? Hello.
He wanted to eat your brain literally and figuratively.
Yeah. What if he wanted to get inside your head and also inside your body and then also eat all of those things? Like,
what if there was a cannibal who like, you're like, I hope he doesn't eat me, but if he does kill me and eat me, I hope it's not because I was rude to him. Because
yes,
I would really like him to think well of me.
Yeah.
I hope at least he had a good reason.
Right.
I hope I eat some of those Roman nuts or whatever so that I taste really good for him.
Yes, literally. Like, it is fascinating. And I also think that, like, he writes very elegantly and it's sort of like a very elegant world. And so that, I think, is sort of like catnip to people that want to like do this stuff for screen, because it's dark, but it's also like, you know, so put together and so classy. Obviously a fact that NBC Hannibal milks extremely well.
Right.
But it's really interesting to look at like Thomas Harris's depiction of the queer community, including like Margot Verger and obviously Buffalo Bill and a lot of like sort of on the sidelines people, even Hannibal himself, as well as like his depiction of women, everything that happens with Hannibal and Clarice in Hannibal the book,
taking every wrong note ever,
a disaster. But like, that's mostly from the book,
right?
So I think that it really speaks to like good filmmaking that a filmmaker like Demme, like we said, was able to sort of create this like very good and elevated and sort of like tender movie in a particular way. Like, I really love how empathetic this movie is towards Clarice. I don't think it's empathetic on every level, but like Clarice's empathy is the thing that like saves her, and the thing that like gives you faith in humanity throughout this movie is that like she's an unfailingly good person, but she's not boring. She's not someone that doesn't have interiority, who like is unshakable by the world. Like, she's very shakable, but she's also just like a good person at her core. And I think that you don't realize how rare that is to see in movies until you watch something like this and you're like, wow, that is a character that I would follow anywhere. Great.
Yeah, she's it's interesting because as like watching it in 2021 and as such an extreme leftist like ACAB, like literally someone who has like gotten in trouble for like posting things like cops literally aren't human, as soon as you join the police force you stop being human,
right.
It is interesting to watch this and be like, and yeah, I think I'm cribbing from like Letterboxd reviews here, but like, the FBI is an evil institution that has caused way more harm than Hannibal Lecter as an individual ever could.
Yep.
And the fact that, like, I don't think she should be in the FBI.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, she's got her traumas that have led her to there because she thinks that's how she fulfills her, like, Oedipal drive or whatever. Yeah. But, she is too good of a person for the FBI. It sucks that there is not a place in our world for people who are good at detecting things that isn't the carceral like system.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do get this like, she's a very good person, but you also do get shades of the complexity of, yeah, she's good, but she's not the rube that Hannibal Lecter thinks she is, because she is, after Crawford has spent this whole movie manipulating her, and then you find out that the offer that was given to Hannibal was completely fake, there's this moment where you worry like, oh shit, was she used again and she had no idea? And then you find out, no, she was in on it. She added, like, she gave it the finishing touch that would be perfect for him, because she's gotten in his head as much as she has, as much as he has hers. She's so complex and sensitive in a way that makes her a good person and a bad person. Yeah. Because it is the sensitive drive to want to care for people that has put her in one of the least caring institutions imaginable.
Right. Yeah. And you wonder, like, down the line, will this sensitivity even be in her? And you see, I think, around her, I think, whether, because Demi, it was interesting listening to the commentary, because it was frustrating, because he was like, he really don't like the FBI as an institution, but making this movie, I like recognize some of the good that they did. He's like said that in the commentary, and I was like, you almost had it. Like, just say that the FBI is a bad institution. You did it. But it's like, you can sort of see the systematic issues, mm-hmm. I think, of the FBI, like the way that Crawford is sexist, and the way that like the police officers and everyone within the film, like there is that inherent like sexist undertone that they never necessarily like punch forward, where it's like, you're an independent woman working in this, how are you doing it? But it's just like the way that they shoot it and like surrounding her can sort of show like the systematic sexism within the FBI, but it doesn't necessarily show like the other horrible things that the FBI is doing. So it's sort of like peeling back and giving you hints of like some bad elements to it, but not necessarily the whole thing.
Yeah,
if you watch this movie, you could be forgiven for thinking that the FBI is just like a massive training school for catching serial killers,
right?
We don't get a glimpse of the other bad shit that they do. It really is like just incredible to read Letterboxd reviews where people say it's great that this movie is such like a deconstruction of the male gaze, and then look at all the comments saying like, why you gotta inject feminism into everything? And it's like, have you not seen the movie? That's the whole, it's the whole thing. The camera at her eye level, the constant like focusing on the way men are reacting to her and treating her, even like the moments where like dudes try and be good, like the way that Jack, after they've been in the funeral parlor and they're in the car, and he says, you know, I had to do that, right? His excuse for why he had to do that isn't the real reason. He's still lying to her and trying to, like, no, he was like just trying to get the cop into a separate room,
right?
And
yeah, it's not even an apology.
No, it's not. It's like, yeah, you're smart enough to know why that happened, right? And she's, and like, she calls him out again in a way that, as a woman, you often have to do, in a way that like couches the real issue and like sort of protects the feelings of the person you're calling out.
Yeah.
And she's like, she's not saying like, no, you did this fucked up thing to me. She's saying like, no, you know to be better and you can do it. And yeah, it's a movie about how it is to exist in patriarchy.
Mm. Yes. And like, Demi is so good with the faces and the eyes.
The way
and
he
like
shoots. It's
using his camera. Yeah. Go for
it's
it,
It's the
Jordan.
Subject. He knows how to like shoot with Tak Fujimoto. But like, the Demi specifically, it's like all about like subjectivity and like the way that you frame people and like getting in their heads. And as you were saying, Avery, it's like, we never see Jody like look into the camera. She's always like degrees off, but everyone else, like from Hannibal Lecter to like Paul Lazar as that like bug guy, like they will look directly at her. So we are seeing the way that these men are looking at Clarice, and by Clarice never looking directly towards the audience, we're getting into her POV, which then again builds up to the final act, where then we switch into a different point of view for the first time, which makes then again that Buffalo Bill sequence hit so hard. But by doing that all in the beginning with Clarice, we see the way that like women are constantly like looked at and like gazed upon, and it's just gross, but it's so effective, and it gets you to like show like the raw emotional like interiority of all these characters and like see what they're thinking so clearly.
It's very odd in a good way to have characters stare directly down the lens and to get the sense that they are looking at you, the viewer. Like, it has to be used extremely effectively and like with restraint. And I think that this movie does such a good job making that so subtle that the first couple of times I watched it, I didn't even really process it, because I was like, yeah, I don't know, this uncomfortable feeling that I'm feeling is like how I usually feel when this is happening in the real world. And then like, you know, after you get a little sense of, oh, I see what the movie is doing, to understand, like, right, it's trying to put you in this very specific uncomfortable position as a woman.
It's wild how easily it like sneaks up on you too, because it's like, I think about that first time you go down the hall to see Hannibal and like you round the corner and he's looking, like, at looking you. At you.
Yeah.
But it doesn't draw attention to itself. It's just all of a sudden you're in it and you're staring at Hannibal, you know? And it just, the way, like, and I was really trying to pick up on it when we were at the cemetery watching it, like to see the cuts to coming into it. And it is so smooth, because I feel like nowadays, like, people will hard cut if they're going to have that, like, staring into the camera or anything like that, mm-hmm. versus this movie where it just sort of casually builds into it, where, like, it's happening a lot. Like, each scene will do it, but it's not in a way that's so flashy and drawing attention to itself. Like, look, the character's staring at you. Like, you can see them. Instead, it's just, like, it's happening naturally.
Yes. They also never technically break the fourth wall. They are, right. are never looking somewhere right. else and then end up looking at you.
I also just think it's a great way of making, like, aside from, like, the social commentary of it, like, it's also just a great way of making scenes that are just two people talking way more interesting and compelling. Like, I am constantly, like, I didn't finish film at university, so my like film theory education is pretty basic. It's mostly YouTube videos.
I don't think you miss too much. Hate to break it to you.
And so, like, one of the major, like, lenses, for better or worse, that I view film through is, like, the Red Letter Media, like, takedowns of the Star Wars prequels.
Yep. Very familiar.
There's they have their own problematic elements that you sort of have to excise. But yeah, when they talk about, there's a scene where people are talking and someone is serving blue milk that no one really ends up drinking, but the act of serving it is meant to be the action in the scene that makes the scene more than just people talking. And I think about that so much. And also in those early seasons of Breaking Bad, when Skyler would be constantly applying lotion, because they were like, you can't just have two people talking on screen, right? It's got to be action. So Walt would be putting clothes back into the wardrobe and she would be putting on lotion. And you'd be like, does she have psoriasis? What's happening? I think one of the things that's great about film and television is that, no, if you have a compelling script, it really is just fine to watch two actors talk to each other.
Yes.
And the production system that we have is so afraid of taking that kind of risk, and it's such, like, received wisdom at this point that you can't do that, mm-hmm. that it is great to see a film that's, like, not, like, it isn't just saying, okay, we can just sit down and watch these two people talk and that will be compelling, which I think it would, but it's also saying, okay, well, here's a way of getting around the idea that you need to have an action. Let's have the action be, this person is staring at you and you have to, yeah, like, live with the fact that right now Hannibal is boring into your eyes and gazing into your soul.
Yes.
While he also gets out this exposition or, you know, character development or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's an incredibly effective script. Like, this is not a long movie. It, like, just cracks 2 hours, if it even does. Like, it is not long. There's not a single wasted scene. It's one of those, like, very, very rare movies where even the scenes that are filler are, like, telling you incredibly important things.
Yeah.
The establishing shots are telling you incredibly important things. It's just so good. And so it gives you the freedom to kind of do that exciting stuff. Like, let's just put two characters in a room and let them do their thing. And, like,
they just got so lucky. How quick it is, but it does sort of, like, breathe.
It takes,
like,
its time.
You're never, like, rushed. I think about, like, the FBI scene a lot. And, like, sort of, I feel like the first half is so tight, but the second half, it's like these long sequences where we're, like, either losing Clarice or we're losing Hannibal, and you're sort of with these new people, and you would expect, like, in a modern movie, it would be, like, these very, like, quick things. I feel like, especially with the elevator sequence, but it's like, we're with those FBI guys for a while.
They get opening credit billing. They're that important.
it's funny. When I was watching it for this record, it'd been a little while since I'd seen it. And so when basically halfway through the movie, Hannibal's gone, and I remembered, like, oh yeah, we're not going to see him to the end of the film. Does the rest of this movie, like, sort of drag them without that propulsive, like, the electric energy of his scenes. It's like, no, it just keeps like going and you don't even really miss him because the rest, it's just so intense the rest of the movie.
Yeah, it's great. It's that fake out, the doorbell ringing fake out is like, how many times can I use the word iconic? Like, so iconic. I showed this to my boyfriend when I was watching this for the record, and somehow he made it through film school without ever seeing this movie, which is I know, right? I was actually shocked. And we got to the beginning of that sequence, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so excited. Like, you have no idea what's coming. And he was like, oh, this is the fake out thing. They showed this to me in a class. And I was like, oh my God.
No,
I was so ready to see someone experience it for the first time.
That would have been amazing.
But it's so good. It's like one of the only times where like the doorbell fake out sequence gets you every time. I've seen this movie, I can't even count how many times I've seen it, and every time it's still so thrilling, intercutting between the basement ringing and the doorbell ringing. It's great. It's a very propulsive third act. Demi knows what he's doing. He deserved
the
best
win.
Director
deserved the win. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's so good. Can I talk about my NBC Hannibal tangent?
Sure.
Okay. Avery, I'm so glad to have you on as a fan. Everyone that we've had on has basically been a fan, which is really exciting.
I don't know anyone who doesn't like the show.
It's a great show. I know people who don't like the show.
Really?
I know people I was in romantic relationships with, and I said, this is so exciting. I'm going to get to show you Hannibal. And we get four episodes in, and they're like, yeah, this sucks. And I'm like, okay. I mean, maybe keep going, because I know it's like kind of a procedural thing right now. Maybe that's a bit boring, but it gets you get these really great images and relationship, and there's And she was just like no, not
what?
That's so sad.
The arcs of those. I wanted that fourth season so bad,
so badly. So there's an incredible Rolling Stone interview that Brian Fuller did when they were talking about when Hannibal dropped on Netflix and like it like cracked the top 10. People were like, oh my God, is this a chance for season 4? By the way, we're never getting season 4. It's never happening.
The Clarice show came out. Remember?
Yes.
Remember Clarice?
Was it called Clarice?
Yes.
Bad.
Clarice.
Did not watch the pilot. I did read some recaps about what was happening because I wanted to keep an eye on it. It sounded quite bad.
They do have like a trans. They will get to like trans representation because they have a trans character in it. They like talked about like how they wanted to have the trans character named Julia played by an actual trans person, which is good.
Huge plus.
And it's basically like they lived through the transphobia caused by Buffalo Bill within the show. So it's like a little metatextual. And for that, I was like, I might watch that. And then no, because it just didn't look good otherwise. But
yeah, and it sounds like it's a very basic like murder of the week thing. And also they don't have really any of the good characters besides Clarice. So it's her and frickin' Paul Krenler, who nobody cares about him.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
But anyway.
You're Rolling Stones.
So Brian Fuller gave this amazing Rolling Stone article. And he was talking about like the campiness in the Thomas Harris novels and how like they're so elevated and elegant and how that like led to all of the crazy images that you see on screen in NBC Hannibal. And he has this great quote about Silence of the Lambs that I want to read because it made me see the movie in like a totally new way. And also sort of like adds another layer to sort of like the queer representation of it, where he was like, I did find, because Hannibal Lecter is such a dandy, Silence of the Lambs struck me as such a queer film because Jodie Foster communicates a queerness about her and Anthony Hopkins in his kind of dandified manner in playing Hannibal Lecter. There was a queer quality as well. So the love affair that's depicted in the book Hannibal, and then later in the movie, between Clarice and Hannibal felt like in some way it was really about the blindness to that camp quality to the characters and the writing. So when I was watching Silence of the Lambs, I didn't get romance between these two. I absolutely got that these were both queer characters, and even the touch between them is so heavily dramatized in Jonathan Demme's movie. The caress of the fingers when he's handing over the file, when they're exchanging a folder, feels less sexualized so much as it was about intimacy. And I read that article and I was like, I'm so obsessed. I'm never watching Silence of the Lambs the same way again. This is now a queer mentor-mentee relationship.
I mean, he's queer both because of like the dandy aspects to him, and he's also queer like in like a sort of queer theory sense of like anyone who is like removed from society in some way becomes queer. The fact that he is a horrific psychopath is queer. Like, I as an anti-carceral state person, I don't want anyone to be in prison. I admit, maybe if Hannibal existed, you would need to keep him somehow locked up, which is very tricky. But yeah, like when you have a person, like, not just put in prison, but buried in a hole in the ground because everything about them is so antithetical to how we need to live together in a society. He's queer. He's queer as hell. And Jodie, I think it's impossible to watch Jodie Foster in a movie and not be like, okay, so this character's a lesbian. Like,
yes,
it
yes.
just screams out of
yeah.
her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think an interesting thing about queer relationships can be that sometimes you're with a person and you realize it's not that I'm attracted to them as a man or a woman or anything, and it's not that I'm currently gay or bi or whatever. It's that I am queer and I'm attracted to other queerness.
Yes.
They don't have, like, it's not a dandy in love with a lesbian. It is two queer people recognizing each other for the queer people that they are inside the oppressive structures that they're both in.
Yeah.
And the way that they get to be free with each other in a kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They're out of place within the structures that they are stuck in. Like, they feel that othering. And I think that it makes the relationship, specifically in Silence of the Lambs, but, you know, as all of the movies, like, inform each other, it makes the Hannibal-Clarice relationship so exciting to me to be like, this is actually born. This is not born out of, like, romantic sexual love, yeah, like right off the bat. This is born out of, like, a shared experience and a shared recognition that, like, you do not belong in the place in which you have been put, and, like, I see that, and I think that we can help each other in that way. And it's also, like, there's a very specific power dynamic between Clarice and Hannibal, and I think, like, looking at it as a mentor-mentee relationship is about a billion times better than people will say we're in love. Even though I love that line, I think that line fits very well. But then, of course,
he's topping from the bottom, right?
For sure.
Well, it's so interesting because people, like, totally walk away from this movie thinking that it is, and because I mean, like, those scenes are played like, not like a romance, but as, you know,
intimate
flirting, and you're like, it's, they're trying to, like, get information out of each other. But I do like I like that read on it a lot.
Thank you,
and
Brian
I completely
Fuller.
Agree with your Jodie Foster thing, which I think is so fascinating, and it kind of, I think, like, sticks with her for her whole career, which is one of those, her career, which we could get into or not, but it's just, like, one of those fascinating things where it's, like, such a private person and has so much, like, tangled up in, like, because I think she's been around for so long, there's so much happening there, but, like, ostensibly, like, one of the earliest, like, out lesbians, even though she wasn't necessarily, like, claiming she was out, it was sort of just, like, there, and people were like, you are, but, like, we're not saying you are, and you are not saying you are, but, like, the energy she's giving is so very clear.
Yeah,
so you're just,
it's
like, I don't
classic
know.
Open secret stuff, right?
Yes, right, right,
of course. And she never, like, you know, had a beard or, like, was seen publicly,
right,
like, with a man in any way, shape, or form. And I mean, there's that iconic interview from when she's, like, 12, when they're like, so do you have a boyfriend, and she just goes kind of like, it's so good. It's the gay silence meme. It's great. But, like, I remember when she won at the Golden Globes this year, and it was like she and her, like, her wife were, yeah, I don't know if they're married or not, but her and her life partner were, like, together on this Zoom record, and, like, they kissed when she won, and people were like, yeah, this is
right.
We've actually, like, never seen anything like this from her. And
yeah,
I don't know. It you know, affects me a little bit because I feel like there's so much of it that is, like, this kind of, like, or was for so long, this open secret, like, well, you can't talk about it. Like, we won't, like, force you into anything, but, like, you have to be so, so careful about it. I don't know. It's like, and to have that all tied up in, like, regular privacy anyway, like, I don't want people to know what I'm doing with my private life, regardless of whether they approve or not.
And all the horrible things that then happen with her private life. So it's just like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it's really crazy how homophobia and, like, general anti-queerness, like, really, like, worms its way in to people's lives in ways that are so, like, unexpected. I think Jodie Foster is obviously incredible, and like I think that she has incredible range, and I love how in this movie you're like, yeah, she, it doesn't seem like she's interested in men, and that fits so well for the character, and that's like kind of what you want.
It is so fun. It's such a good like just a glimpse into the experience of being a woman who's not into men. And not that this is me, because I don't go out much, and when I do, people don't flirt with me, but the constant, like, every man she encounters, like, tries to get it wet. And,
yeah.
You know, not to blame them. I would shoot my shot with Jodie Foster, too. I mean, I'd be like, let's go to dinner and let's talk about Mel Gibson a little bit, and maybe I can try and convince you of some things. But
we'll talk about the Beaver movie. Like,
it's yeah. one of those... It's one of those things where, yeah, it is just, that is for a lot of women what it is like every day to just yeah. have, whether you're into men or not, just have men constantly trying to shoot their shot. And she just, she does such a good job of, again, the empathy of her character, the way she subtly like swerves them yeah. Is really good. She's great. I want her to at least be my wing. I want the character to be my wing woman when I go out to both fend off dudes, and then also, like, I don't know, maybe ladies will come up to us trying to get with her. She'll be like, oh, I'm married to the FBI, kind of. It's like, you know, I don't have time for a prison. But, you know, Avery's great.
Obsessed, yes. I think we would all love that. And
I feel like it sort of like redefines like women roles for like going forward. And like, I feel like we're sort of having this fascinating period now where it's like she is so independent, she's like doesn't have a love interest, isn't sexualized, and like we have started to see that wave where like we start to get these strong protagonists. And I feel like we're coming at this interesting angle now where it's like the hyper
feminist
where it's like, as we were talking about, like gunpowder milkshake and like all of those, where it's like so trying to be what this movie I think just is, where it's just like a naturalistic feminism versus like a forced feminism.
Here's,
does that
the
make
thing
sense?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Here's the thing: if your piece of media is feminist, you don't need to tell the audience that it's feminist. Right. The audience will be able to see it.
Okay, but what about the best movie of all time, Promising Young Woman, which every line was a character saying either I'm a feminist or I'm not a feminist.
Right.
And it was the best movie of all time, and we're so happy it happened. Wow, it's funny to think that movie, it wants so badly for that character to be Jodie Foster in Silence of the Lambs, and just whiffs it on every level.
I think every movie like wants her.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
It's quite difficult because what you were talking about, Avery, with like the example of, you know, media is afraid to let two people just sit in a room and have a conversation. And, you know, I think that in a way I can understand this because people wildly misinterpret things so frequently.
What do you mean?
I don't want to talk about it. But I think that it's difficult for movies to be like, we can just let the character speak for themselves without having to like let the audience know what this movie is trying to do. Like, there's no way to read Silence of the Lambs as anti-feminist or not feminist, and yet you still have people on Letterboxd being like, why are you trying to inject a social agenda into this movie?
Yeah,
which totally ties with the trans read of this movie too, which is all, it's sort of like a counter and at the, like, at the same time affirming with that point where it's like Lecter basically says like he's not really transsexual, and we can dig into like the actual nuances of that, where they're basically trying to say like not actually a trans person, like thinks that like if he can like get all the skin to dress like a woman that it will like free him from his traumas, blah blah blah. But
bad plan, by the way, this half constructed skin suit we see, that
not
doesn't
great.
Age well.
No,
not
no, it's
cute.
Gonna get gross and it will smell.
Not
how are you gonna
cute.
Wash that thing? Yeah,
yeah, no. But it's like they try to like semi tell you like a little bit, but then at the same time they show you Buffalo Bill doing the dance and the tuck, and you're like, you're showing the audience. But then of course, as you were saying with audience misinterpretation, they see that and they immediately go like, oh, this is like all trans people are like killers. So it's like, how much can you trust an audience, which is so fucking frustrating, especially because it comes with queer representation so much,
right?
Or like women on screen, etc. It's like audiences are so dumb at times, it just like aren't able to understand like the nuances to certain things or like read between the lines at all.
It's very tempting to say, like, you can't trust audiences, but, like, as someone who believes in the innate goodness and intelligence of every person on the planet, yeah. like, it's not that you can't trust audiences because they're dumb. It's because they've been trained right. to, if you put this movie out today, we don't have a film-going population that has the tools to right. be able
yes.
to properly interpret a movie. Not that there's one way to interpret a movie or whatever, but, like...
yeah.
Yeah, if you watch 20 Marvel movies in a row and then watch this movie, you are gonna lose your mind because you yeah. won't be able to understand what it's doing.
Right.
It's a completely separate thing. And it's like, I think that the Buffalo Bill example speaks to, like, if you, you know, an image is worth a thousand words. If you have a damaging image on screen, it can yeah. undo all of sort of like any damage you tried to mitigate in the dialogue, which right. I think it's obviously like very speaks to the time and is like not yes. perfect, but they do put a pretty fine point on that. Like, this is not a trans character. This is someone who thinks that he is trans because he's traumatized and is looking for a way out of it. And it's, yet,
like, it's tough saying. Because as a trans person, that's what you get told constantly.
Right. Mm. Right.
And like, especially the time this movie came out, like, you could not get diagnosed as trans if you did not fit a very specific box. That's maybe right. like beginning to change slightly. But I mean, I have a doctor's appointment in 3 days now. So I'm glad I reinstalled Zoom for this record because the whole set me up for that. But like, I've been out for, so I'm 33 now, I came out as 19, so almost 15 years, which is very scary. I am fully like in myself. I'm fine with being trans. I barely think about it anymore. I don't think anyone has any room to question me on the fact that I am who I say I am. I'm still terrified to see my doctor in yeah. a few days because the whole system was set up. Even like when I was coming out, I was reading the message boards saying, here's what you need to say in your interviews so that they do not rubber stamp you as a man who has some weird delusion. Mm. And like, it is impossible to know if Buffalo Bill really is trans or not.
Right.
Because we aren't inside, I'm going to say his because I think, you know,
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
We're not inside his head, and you can't apply the diagnostic criteria to someone who is a serial murderer. So I can't yeah. say, like, yeah, we can see the skin suit as an expression of a real trans urge. Like, yeah, I don't know. It just seems like a psycho. Like, I mean, he's literally a combination of multiple different real life murders, right? So there's yeah. not a person like this that exists or could exist because it's so many people mushed into one. But yeah, yeah. that line, it doesn't give them the get out of jail card that they think it does as
yeah.
right. filmmakers. They really wanted to have their cake and transition it to, and it just, if
it's
if
the tagline.
Yeah. If you're not up on the issues, you can like watch the movie and be like, oh, okay, it's not trans, so it's fine. But yeah, and then they still follow it up with those lurid shots of like,
right.
do you see how disgusting it is when a man puts on lipstick? I'm going to get in really close to show you how gross it is.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is like, we've had the larger conversation on a couple episodes about like depicting queer people like as bad people on screen,
like,
and how like we sometimes are like, we wish that we could just have queer representation for people being evil without like all of the baggage that comes with it. And of
right.
course, I think like for trans specific characters, it's like especially like can be so damaging, as this movie shows. And it's like, sometimes you just want to have fun with an evil queer villain, and you can't do that because of like literally like prejudice in society and like how people interpret or misinterpret things. And right. then as a result, like, you don't get a lot of queer representation, and that's like what this podcast is all about. I'm spiraling.
No, you're spot on.
I think that like it's so incredibly exciting when you see a filmmaker that can like pull off a multifaceted queer character, because you just want to be able to see them like anybody else and like let them have positives and negatives and like be bad people.
Mm.
Yeah.
You mean just like be a person.
Right.
Be a flawed human being. Yeah.
Well, that's why I like NBC Hannibal, because right. it's like, what if Hannibal was a pansexual serial killer who fell in love with this FBI profiler and then slowly turned him into both a queer lover and also a serial killer at the same time? And it's like, that's one yeah. of the best stories that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But like, I don't want the general public to necessarily get that story, because like, I'm a little worried.
And then you're like, oh, the general public would be like, oh, is this XYZ?
This is capital P problematic.
It's so hard, because as a person living in culture and forced to live in like mainstream culture, there's not really any way out of it unless you go into a cabin in the woods, right? You're going to see movies and you're going to want to see yourself represented in them.
Yeah.
And it's never really going to happen, because the very, like, mainstream Hollywood movies are culture, and queerness is antithetical to culture, and culture maintains itself by othering people and saying, if you are queer, you are wrong. Yes. So there's, you know, you'll get maybe rare glimpses of it, but you're never going to have a mainstream Hollywood movie say, this is a queer person, they are complicated, and that is great, because that destroys the project of mainstream culture,
right?
But yeah. Which is the, why
this is
which is why I think, you know, I'm not a fan of representation politics in general, because it's I think it's a bit of a trap. Absolutely. But also, like, as someone who tries to make things as a queer person, and like, I'm very into the idea of, if you want your representation, go to independent media, but like, I'm writing a book right now, and it is a trans woman protagonist, and she is an extremely bad person. And I worry every time I write one of the bad things she does that I'm doing other trans people wrong, that I'm saying like, oh, if you're making independent media, then you have to have like an evil, like, trans person, or it's not authentic. And it's like, it's just, there's just traps everywhere.
This is like half of the conversations that we have about writing. Like, if we're writing something, or like just even talking about it, we're like, fuck, like, I want to have this flawed character. And like, it's like with bi people, it's like, I want to have this bi character, and I want them to like start out, like, even if you like the most basic thing, like a relationship that they're in, and you're like, I want them to start off with like, be dating a woman, you know what I mean? But like, even that, you're like, am I doing a disservice by it? But you know,
are
by
you
that-
saying, are you saying like the only way you can be really bi is if you date in a quote unquote gay way?
Exactly.
And if you do like, oh, okay, she starts dating a man, but then she dates a woman. So you're saying, oh, she's only become valid then if you start with her dating a woman, then go to a man. And you're trying to say like, see, she does both. Then you'll get people saying, oh, so you, but you think she should end up with a man? Like, it's impossible.
There's no way out.
Because mainstream culture has us as queer people in a defensive position where we have to tear apart the cultural products we get presented with to find the, like, the gems hidden in the shit. Yep. We then use those same exact tools on the cultural products we make for each other
Our own. Exactly. Yeah. And it gets turned against us, and like, we turn against each other, and it's like, that's ultimately like not helpful when the end goal is just for us to be able to like put out art that is like representation of us, of who we want to say, like whatever we want to say, like for your story, like, let's fucking read that book, like that rules. And it's like, we shouldn't have to be worried about like that character and like how it fits in, which is so frustrating, because it is that nuanced conversation.
I mean, this is why so much of queer representation sort of like ends up in a gray area.
Yeah.
I mean, this movie, I don't think, is in a gray area when it comes to like that specific type of representation, but so often like the movies that we talk about are, because like that's the only way that it's deliverable to a four quadrant audience. Like, that's what the show is all about. Right. And yeah, it is very frustrating to have to balance these two parts of you, like, as a someone artistic and someone queer who wants to like authentically represent like both parts of yourself. It's very difficult. But also, I think that like really incredible media can come out of that. Like, there is so much stuff that I like that's made by queer people, like for queer people, that like I love, and it is complicated. It's a very slow uphill battle, but it is a battle nonetheless, and I think that we're moving along.
It's a feast that we're eating.
Very slowly. I try to look on the bright side otherwise.
I think it's important. Yeah. You can fall down a hill really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, if I don't look on the bright side, like, what am I doing in this industry? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's anyways. It's tricky. It's the it's like the Bo Burnham, like, what's the point in telling jokes when the world is burning? Like,
yeah.
Right. What is the point in making queer art when, you know, there's laws being passed every day that make people's lives materially worse, right? But yeah, no, like, also you just
have to.
Yeah.
You got it.
If you don't have to be doing this, then get out, because no, that's more Hollywood Havoc stuff there.
But also, yes.
Yeah. But also, yeah.
But also,
it's,
yeah.
It's real. It's cringe, but it's real.
It's cringe, yeah. But it's real.
You know, Brooke, Buffalo Bill, the clothing he wears is human clothes, but do you know someplace you can go to get better clothes? Are you going to say it's a little sweaty, my transition? I don't know. I think it's pretty clean.
Pretty clean. Look.
Look, you don't have to kill a human to get these clothes.
You already know what we're talking about.
What are we talking about?
It's Super Yaki, baby.
Imagine walking down the corridor, you're Clarice Starling, tick talk walking down you round, who's standing there but Hannibal in Super Yaki clothes.
If you love movies, good movies, bad movies, this movie, other movies, Super Yaki is the place for you.
Yeah.
To get all of that and more in the form of super high quality, super comfortable, super inclusive merch. We love them. They have never disappointed. They are coming out with new collections basically every Friday.
It's the best.
And they never miss.
No.
Much like
Hannibal, he never misses.
He only eats. We love Super Yaki, and we love that they joyously bring everyone around the world tangible love letters to movies and filmmakers that we love. It's a beautiful thing.
It is.
And that's sometimes what we need in the middle of all this cannibalistic serial killing.
Look, there's a lot of blood spilling, a lot of fingers and body parts we're finding.
But
to have something nice and tender like Super Yaki,
very
there's nothing
important.
Better.
Very important. And you know, you're in luck if you're listening to this episode, because
we have
a very special little code for you.
We do. What is it?
You can use Super QQ for 10% off at checkout. That's Super QQ, all caps, no spaces.
Wow, you don't even need to kill someone to steal their Super Yaki clothes.
So great. Look, if the spirit moves you for this movie or other movies, for all the movies, you know where to go. It's superyaki.com.
Absolutely.
That's SuperYaki.com.
Ooh, was that, is that your Hannibal?
.com.
Some fava beans and Super Yaki.
For sure. I personally find this movie very inspiring. I really love sort of like blood and gore when it's used well and like used artistically. And I think like, this
so little weirdly
gore,
though, in this movie,
but used so effectively.
Yes,
that's the thing. And
I
like
agree.
I'm fine with like another NBC Hannibal thing, or like Raw, name the bloodiest movies you can think of. Revenge,
great movie.
Like I love, like,
you're just quoting the four movies you just tweeted about in the four movies that should be in the Criterion Collection.
Oh, someone's been stalking my Twitter just a little bit. Yeah, no, I don't. It's actually it's I have a very small profile of films that I like
go to
simp
for.
Revenge is great. Yeah.
Perfect.
There you go. You've unlocked.
We're all
it.
Gonna burn phoenixes actually into our chests.
I like movies about women covered in blood. Okay, I'm a simple woman to please.
The Descent. Do you like The Descent?
I do.
That's a good one. Yeah,
good one. But yeah, I love a lot of gore, but I also like when gore is used like very quickly and very effectively. I love the shot of the guy strung up with the American flag.
It's so good.
It's scary. It's beautiful. It's
gorgeous.
Yeah. Iconic.
Yes.
It's very iconic.
So iconic that they repeat it for NBC Hannibal, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, like, maybe it's from the books, but still. Yeah.
I think that's the beginning of like the tableaus, like the beautiful artistic like death tableaus.
It's because Hannibal's a fucking campy motherfucker. He's like
a dramatic bitch.
To look at my art. Look at the way that I destroyed and like strung up this body. And like when he has Clarice go to the garage, it's like, look at all this creepy shit that I have. Look at the way that like I've draped my car in an American flag, and you're gonna find the producer's head in a jar. You know what I mean?
So oh, is that like, the producer's
it
head?
Is, yeah.
That's a good fun fact. I didn't know that.
That's the producer, and then one of the other producers is my favorite character in the film, which is the doctor when they go to the small town with the bow tie and his face has a million wrinkles and it looks like an old shoe.
Oh yes.
Yes. I love him so much.
He's awesome. He has a great face. Demi has a lot of like regulars that have really great faces.
So many good faces.
Yeah. It's awesome. I don't even remember what my point was, but I like, oh yes.
Oh, him being campy, stringing up bodies, gore.
Yeah, Hannibal's a dramatic bitch. Yeah.
That's the tableaus are so good. There was this, Daniel Lavery tweeted this like earlier this summer, but it just got retweeted onto my TL, and it was, I saved it because I was like, I just watched Silence of the Lambs. But yeah, it's Jack Crawford. Make room for daddy's special little boy with the big imagination. Will, what can you tell us about this livid tower of corpses? Will Graham, inhaling deeply, the killer did this on purpose. Such an incredible deconstruction, obliterating a show I love.
Yes.
It's like...
Absolutely. Yeah. Will shaking like a golden retriever. Oh, God.
That's so funny. Sweating, laying down the blankets on his bed.
Yeah. Yeah.
The comedy that came out of Hannibal, the TV show, I was on Tumblr when Hannibal was airing. I loved all of the Hannibal crack that people would make. Like, those videos were very fun. Also, there's this one, like, image that was just, like, I think about all the time where someone said, like, when everyone discovers that Hannibal is a murderer who eats people, and that it's just like subtitles on a shot of Will going, it fucking rhymes. It's like, it is a crazy thing that he's Hannibal the cannibal. What are the odds?
Do you think Thomas Harris was sitting there writing and he's like, okay, cannibal.
Hannibal.
I'm gonna call my shot that there will be some Fannibals.
Fannibals. I think that Hannibal Buress talks about how like his parents named him after the general, and then like when he was five or whatever, Silence of the Lambs came out, and he was like, "Well, the rest of my life sucks now." I'm sorry for him, but yes, NBC
Famous
Hannibal.
Hannibal Buress.
Yes, of course, of course. We cannot forget.
I am incapable of conceiving of anyone except in terms of things they said on Twitter that I'm mad at them for. So
yes, no, it's great because like I do think it reminds you that, like Jordan said, no one is infallible. You're always gonna find something, so lower your expectations ahead of time.
I mean I'm keeping a woman in my well right now, so
of course, as you do.
That's the screaming was
that's the tricky thing for me with this movie. I'm like, you know, Buffalo Bill, not a real person, doesn't represent us as a trans community, but personally, yeah, I've got someone trapped in a dang well right now. She's kidnapped my dang dog. I'm furious.
The dang dog. A+ to that dog. A great actor. Credited in order of appearance, I would just like to say. At the end, they credit everyone in order of appearance. They also credit the dog in order
Is it Precious as Precious?
No, the dog's name's something
Precious
else.
As the novel Push by Sapphire.
Okay, bad joke. I don't remember what the dog's name is.
Remember that film Precious?
I do remember
based
that
on
film.
The novel Push by Sapphire. I'm gonna keep going for it.
Please
give
don't.
Me it, Brooke.
I'm trying to find the dog's name.
I don't know. I have a question for you, for everyone here.
Okay.
Is just talking, we should probably get into the plot at some point. But
honestly, Jordan, I have to be real with you. I think it's too late, and I think everyone has seen this movie, and it's about a cannibalistic serial killer. So there you go.
An hour plus into the record, I would like to say, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen the movie, go watch the movie.
I think there are scenes that we should discuss within this film.
Okay.
And I think it would be important for us because they are important. It's a big movie. Anyways, what I was going to say is that preliminary casting, there's the two things I want to talk about is, one, do we think the Michelle Pfeiffer, Meg Ryan, or Laura Dern would have been better? Because As a Michelle Pfeiffer diehard, think she would have given a very good performance.
I feel odd saying this because I think it speaks to how often Hollywood casts women. Mm. But like, I think that Jodie Foster is the correct amount of like West Virginia look for this movie. Yeah. Like Michelle Pfeiffer, not that Jodie Foster isn't so beautiful, but Michelle Pfeiffer is just like, you can't look away,
like,
stunning.
Bombshelly.
Particularly in the 90s. Like, I think that it would feel like she was too much out of place, even though I think that performance-wise, she would have been good.
I think Laura Dern is the only one of them that could have done as good a job as Jodie. And you get maybe there's a ruddiness to the face of young Laura Dern that would have worked out.
Yeah.
It is funny when he, when Hannibal says, like, you've got some length of bone, and it's like, what are you talking about? This is the smallest woman who's ever appeared on screen. Yeah. But yeah, no, she does. Yeah. She does have that kind of rural
look. Yeah. Look. Yeah. Yeah. You don't want her to look too much like she was picked out of central casting be in this. Yeah. You want her to look like she's of a piece, especially like given her upbringing and given like how much that she's not concerned with how people see her. Like she's honestly just trying to get through the fucking day.
Right.
I think it's good that they make her like just not stand out. Yeah.
She tried on the first take, she didn't do the accent. Like she was working on not giving the role with the accent. And then Demi was like, can you like kind of bring out the West Virginia a little bit more? And she was like, oh, I thought we didn't want that. And then she brought it out and now we have the movie.
It's perfect.
But like imagine her as not with the accent. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. I think that there's even that line that Hannibal says to her when he's like that accent. Yeah. That you tried so hard to hide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. No, she's not working that hard.
No, it's not that much.
Dr. Lecter? Dr. Lecter?
Yeah. It's great.
I'm slowly going to try and do impressions of everyone in the movie. Yeah.
I love this.
It's great. We're hopeless. Weird ones that we especially can get? Me. Were you also going to talk about the Hannibal castings though? Because that shit is there crazy.
Pacino, De Niro, Hoffman, Jacoby, and Daniel Day-Lewis. I would kill for Pacino, 90s Pacino in this.
This would be a bad movie.
Quid pro quo, doctor.
He's giving heat energy.
I love Demi so much, but I don't think Demi
would not have worked.
Could have saved 90s. No.
Be like, why did you eat that census taker? Because she had a great ass.
Fuck.
A plus.
Nice suit, Senator.
I mean, in Devil's Advocate.
Yes.
I feel like he's kind of trying to do a Hannibal.
Probably.
So maybe that's the closest we get.
Nice.
Devil's Advocate, incredible movie. I love it so much.
What if the devil had an advocate?
But then he was also a lawyer. It's insane.
In one of the weirdest scenes on film, a woman said, do my breasts look real to you? And she has clearly AA cup breasts and has not had implants. And she's going, yeah, I got implants. They're great. I want to talk about the Devil's Advocate so much. It's such a weird movie.
It's
Charlize
bizarre.
Trying to do like a country accent as well. Oh, so good.
Can she do accents? Now you're saying, I'm like... she's good at masking.
Do you remember?
But I don't know if she's good at doing them.
Do you remember when we talked about Atomic Blonde? And I was like,
yes.
I can't tell if she is doing a slightly bad British accent because she's actually supposed to be American.
Yes.
Or if her British accent is just slightly bad. But also, it's not that bad. It's pretty good. Avery's probably more of an expert on the subject of British accents.
Oh, I mean, you've heard throughout this call, my accent is all over the place because I've lived too many places and had too many relationships with people with different accents and absorbed bits of their accents.
As always.
I don't have a sense of self. So, I can't speak to anyone who's like, no, she's, the Atomic Blonde accent is better than the Arrested Development British accent. Mm. So she's on the upswing, I guess.
She's done it.
What does she do in I'm like trying to think of her in Monster where I feel like it's just like, oh, I'm gonna kill this guy who's coming in my car.
It's more of grizzled. A voice affect than an actual accent. I also think that speaking of accents, all of the Americans that they were doing for or auditioning for Hannibal would have either had to have done some sort of European accent, God forbid, or like it just doesn't fit if they're American.
Yeah.
Like he's canonically European, and
so
even though it's not mentioned,
you would have wanted Sean Connery.
Oh yes, absolutely.
It, yeah. I'm going to go. Oh god, I can't do it. I wish it's like shush. I'm going to kill.
Oh, there, Clarice.
Quid pro quo, Doctor Jones.
I mean, what's the
No.
Yeah,
what
I don't
Max
know.
Throw at you?
Oh no.
Very quickly devolving. I could have seen Day-Lewis do this.
For sure, yeah. All of them, he's definitely the best. Like, De Niro would have just been, like, steely and giving Cape Fear or, like, any other scary De Niro performance, you know?
He would have been a little young at the time, maybe,
yeah.
Day-Lewis.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that I like that. So look,
when did
Hopkins is not a large guy, but I like that he's kind of solid. He's solid.
Yes.
And he has.
Well, he like also does gravitas. He does one of my favorite things that actors do, the Tom Cruise, where you puff your chest out to make yourself look bigger and you have a sort of weird arch to you. Where like when he comes around, he like looks. Viewer listeners can't see it, but like he like puffs. It's like a half. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like curving.
I mean, that jumpsuit is
convex.
Yes.
Yeah.
That jumpsuit is not doing him any favors.
No.
Let me tell you.
The jumpsuit, though, fitted.
Yeah. Kind of hot.
He wanted that. He was like, I need to be in white. And it worked.
He gets some height given to him when he's strapped into the like the stand-up gurney like hand truck thing. Because you count the handles in the height on that one. And it really it adds a few inches.
Yeah.
Same with the hat at the end.
Oh, the hat. The great hat and the great wig and the bug crawling on his face.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It is one of the things that I read. This is a part of the Criterion Collection. The Criterion Collection's sorry, but the essay I was trying to go
the Criterion
the
essay
has it's a fucking an amazing essay. Yeah. But one of the points that they talk about is basically like how in the final shot, how it's like so much of this is about like American iconography, like as we were saying earlier, like the flags and like where the car is draped in an American flag representing. And Demi talks about it too in the commentary, how it's basically just like America covering up like the atrocities that we've committed, and whether or not like audiences would pick up on that, it's there.
Demi.
I think one of the final things is so interesting is basically like serial killers are kind of an American creation, and like the sensationalism of them and like the way in which that we have become so obsessed with like true crime and everything. And while that wasn't necessarily like true crime as we see it today with podcasts and stuff is very different than now, but the obsession with serial killers was very big then. And so basically like this American creation of like a serial killer has been like let loose in a third world country, and it's like again the repercussions of like American trauma and horror released into a foreign country. And I was like, that is such a beautiful read of that last shot, because it's one, also he's gonna have an old friend for dinner, of course, but like that's so fascinating, that read of like this inherently American thing that is just a killer is now released somewhere.
Yeah. Also interesting when you weigh that against the fact that Hannibal is like a European gentleman. Like he's,
well, yeah.
The reason that he's so compelling is that he's decidedly un-American.
Right.
He has this sort of this foreign class, this foreign respect and like set of morals, where like the other serial killers, i.e. Migs, are like what you'd expect. And like so much of this film takes place in like rural, like white trash America, and that Hannibal is like so above it all because he's not one of the people. Yeah.
I think that depiction of middle America, I think, is what's fascinating, because it is sort of, I think, at this interesting point where it's kind of like post-Reagan, we're coming into like the new wave, you know what I mean, like where you have like Clinton coming into office and everything like that. I think it's like this interesting decline of, you know, the 80s boom in America, where then like this part of America starts to decline and we start to like see the separation of like the socioeconomic classes more.
There we go.
With the coasts. And I again think like that digs into further what we have now, where you have like such distinct lines within America of like progressive versus not, and by it being sort of in this like boonies, you know, not really established place, it's sort of fascinating because it's like this high class killer and like these crazy things happening, but in like a rather vanilla setting where like it's kind of bland.
One of the things that's interesting about America and about Hannibal Lecter is that Americans are very bad at knowing what America looks like to other people.
Yes.
and analyzing its own socio-political issues, really. And like even that line I mentioned, the thing about how good nutrition has given her some length of bone, and it's like it is worth mentioning, because yeah, if you grow up where she did in the time she did, odds are, because of your class, you might suffer from some malnutrition. I grew up incredibly working class and definitely dealt with that. And yeah, the fact that he is an outsider to America means, both because of like the accent and stuff. I personally know I spent a lot of time in America in my early 20s, and you can just get so far on a British accent. part of the reason I enjoyed being there as like a fairly newly out trans woman was because the accent just covers up so much and people were willing to give me so much leeway in my presentation. But yeah, no, the fact that he has this like genteel sensibility, one of the most interesting things about Hannibal the show is the way that people don't know how to act around him. And also it gives him this like laser focus on the way people are acting around him. And the fact that by the time we see him in The Silence of the Lambs, he was obviously a monster when he came to America, but now, yeah, he has become this American monster. And probably it's hard to see Hannibal getting caught and put in prison for so long unless he has inherited some fallibility by becoming Americanized. Mm-hmm. Because the perfect version of Hannibal is that, like, fresh off the boat, incredibly cultured stranger. And the more he becomes familiar, the easier he is to catch, maybe? This is not in the text of the film, but it's in the text of Hannibal, the NBC show, one of the best shows of all time.
The best show of all time. Yes, I agree. And I think that, like, Silence of the Lambs is part of the reason that makes it so successful is like there's so much implied history. I think that's why Manhunter is very good too. Red Dragon has like that stupid flashback at the beginning. And like,
it's so frustrating because Red Dragon's like, of the Harris books, it's probably the best one.
It also has, you know what I mean? Really weird queer themes.
It's so queer.
Like, it's so
how do you feel about Manhunter? Like the
film?
Yeah, like with the queer like subtext within that versus... Because I feel like Man kind of bakes it out a little bit.
I think that most... including Red Dragon. This is just my opinion. Yeah. I think including Red Dragon, most versions of Francis Stollerhide have done I think it speaks to like, you know, it's cinema, it's on screen. You're not going to like really go into like the psyche as much, but like have done a good job removing themselves enough from like... sort of like the implied homosexuality as serial killer that is in the text.
Yeah.
And I think NBC Hannibal uses it to its advantage with having like this sort of like deeply homoerotic relationship between Francis and Will and then Francis and Hannibal and like the obsession that all sort of like comes together. And it just feels better because like Brian Fuller feels like he's in on the joke. But I think that it's a little bit of a sticky situation. Not as sticky as Silence of the Lambs because it's easier to ignore.
Mm.
Yeah. But I think that what I like about the depiction of Hannibal in Silence of the Lambs and in Manhunter is that like there's all this implied history and you only see him in prison.
Yeah.
And so you have to draw your own conclusions and you draw the conclusion like what led him here? What was the mistake that he made? And it doesn't dwell too much on that and it just kind of like lets you draw your own conclusions and like enjoy the story that's in front of you.
Like how exhausted is like Jack Crawford from his past relationship with Hannibal? Like what the fuck had happened between the two? Like why does he send this like young FBI trainee to go like deal with him? Like what happened there? And like Hannibal immediately picking up on him and be like, oh, Jack Crawford sent you. So the name recognition too, immediately like him being able to be like, oh, Jack Crawford, like that guy. Me and him, we go back, but you know?
It's kind of crazy that Silence of the Lambs is so effective and all the character stuff it does, despite not even touching on any of like the past history. Will Graham is never mentioned. Paul Krendel is only mentioned in regards to the FBI. Same with Jack Crawford. Like you have no idea if Hannibal just knows Jack Crawford from what he's seen in the papers or if he like actually has a history with him. It's great.
Yeah. I think the NBC show is at its worst when it tries to get concrete answers to Hannibal's past.
Yeah.
Mm. Like the stuff when, they go to like his childhood home and find his sister and stuff. And Hannibal is at his best when you just find out another thing that he can do that he's an expert at for no reason. Like, when he's in, is it Venice? And he has to give that talk extempore and he absolutely nails it, no problem, gives one of the best talks in the history of the college or something. And it's like, I don't need a history to him because I want to think of him as this supernatural figure that Yeah, if you try and pull the thread of like, okay, so how did he have time to learn how to be a gourmet chef and speak fluent Italian and like be able to talk about Dante and also like be an incredible surgeon and a psychiatrist? Yep. Like it doesn't add up unless you're just like, no, this man is the devil. You don't need history on the devil. You just need to watch the devil do his work because it's fascinating.
Having just watched every Halloween movie, you're hitting on a point that I'm really into, which is the first Halloween film works so well because we don't know what the fuck happened. We get the opening scene of Michael, obviously, like one of the most transcendent scenes in horror history. But then from that, it's just he's the shape. He is this killing being. We don't know about him. We don't get his motives. That's it. And what subsequent movies falter with is they keep trying to explain what's the cause of Michael. Why is Michael doing what he's doing? What's the history there? Let's peel back the layers to why this killer is a killer, not realizing that like the most interesting thing about him is that we don't know anything about him. And like Demi talked about this movie being a slasher film devoid of slasher scenes, which I think is fascinating because it ostensibly is. Like we don't have a, you know, Michael Myers going around with a knife, but you have like the killers going around killing people. And by viewing sort of like Hannibal as this just like beast that exists and we don't know his backstory makes him such a fascinating, you know, person in a box. Like we're trying to figure out what's going on with him while he's trying to figure out what's going on with Clarice. And so it like makes the audience ask so many questions versus just giving us everything on a platter, which I feel like so many movies nowadays are faltering with because they're just like, we have to explain every minute detail about how this happened and how X got to Y.
It's the and like, lore.
Right. And it's just like, sometimes lore, we don't need it. Like, sometimes I want to see a mysterious killer because they're a mysterious killer. Like, don't tell me why they're doing this thing. Like, it takes the scares away, actually.
It's the whole horror movie principle that whatever people are putting on screen is never going to be as scary as what your imagination comes up with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fear of the unknown is a phrase. It's interesting that slasher movie without any slashing thing, because it is funny how this, like, complex psychological, like, thriller ends up resolving into there are two people, they each have a gun pointed at each other. And yeah, there's no knife, there's no slashing. It's just like, yeah, it's just guns. And the drama inherent in that. And I think it's so, another of the dozens of things this movie does really well is that like, okay, he has the goggles on her. He has the advantage. I was thinking of it in terms of Fortnite because I play so much of it. But in that game, you know, you're constantly building up to try and get height because whoever has height is probably going to win. And like, so I'm thinking of it in terms of like, yeah, he's got the night vision. He's got the gun drawn. He has the advantage. But like in Fortnite, even if you have height, you can still lose. Even though he's got the night vision goggles and a gun pointed on her, she can't see. He could and does still lose because it's a gun and guns are so dangerous. They're so scary. Guns are really, really scary.
Yeah.
And like does he have like a magnet? It's like a big thing, right? Like if he had hit her with that, he would have killed her.
Yeah.
And so even him knowing, okay, if I just get one shot off on this, she's dead. He still has to reckon with the fact, yeah, she has a gun. And if she hits me with it, I'm probably dead too because they're so scary. So I have to be careful with this.
Yeah.
I think it's so smart and it makes it so tense in a way that a lot of gunfights, like there's what, four shots fired, maybe five. Mm-hmm. It is more tense and thrilling than the LA shootout in Heat. And
even
though, I mean, that is very tense, but there were hundreds of thousands of bullets.
That's like the complete opposite approach. Michael Mann is like, what I'm if I just overwhelm?
Yeah. And I guess 100%. That's like, I guess that's why Westerns are good, right? Like, it eventually comes down to two people, a gun pointed at each other, who's going to get the shot off first. So is Silence of the Lambs a Western?
Is it secretly a Western?
A slasher Western. Ooh. Yeah. I mean, look, Westerns are about, like, Americana. This film is about Americana. And also, at the heart of every good Western is a relationship between very complicated people on either side of a moral quandary that actually care about each other. And
cowboys are inherently queer.
Of course.
They're removed from mainstream society.
Yes.
So, yeah.
all I want is a string of gay Westerns. That's really everything that's important to me. But yeah, well,
I haven't seen Cry Macho yet, but I assume that's what it is, right? It's about machismo, so that's pretty camp.
It's a, did you, having just watched it literally like last night or two nights ago, did you know Cry Macho is the name of the rooster?
Oh, wow. Okay.
I did.
It blew my mind.
I think it was in one of the trailers. Yeah.
I did not watch a trailer, just saw the poster and I was like, sold.
And then it was fine.
Yeah. That's actually pretty tender.
Okay.
I kind of actually like, you didn't watch it. You haven't seen it.
I'm just saying I will maybe check it out.
Yeah. So don't say it's fine without seeing it.
It's on my Plex waiting for me to decide I'm in the mood to watch a Clint Eastwood movie, but
it's like, yeah, it is. I mean, it's fine, but it's like very, it's suspiciously tender and wholesome, which I wasn't expecting.
It's always nice when movies that are not meant to be tender, like have it in the middle, have like a nice core of tenderness. Yeah. We actually talked about this on the Inception episode recently. How it's like that is what drives filmmaking. That's one of the reasons I like Silence of the Lambs so much, is because like we said, Clarice is someone that you like is tender and that you care about, but like she still fits into this movie the exact way that you want her to. It's great. I think that more movies should do it. And like, it's hard to make authentic tender movies that are not just like cloying. Because if you're trying too hard, the audience is gonna know immediately and it just like ruins everything. But that I think is like what part of like what makes you want to come back to a movie over and over and over again is like that seed of like, there is good and like this is the good that we can find.
I think it's a Demi thing too.
Or if you're just like,
because like all of his movies are so human and like he cares so deeply about people, and like that's like my thing with like Something Wild and like with all of these movies, like they're all so much about like people and like humans and like how much like we care and like why it's important to care about people.
Yeah.
And like that's what makes them, like it's not like a movie where you're like, oh, the world is terrible. And even though it's like Something Wild, the second half is so scary, but it's so good because it's like it lets you come back to it versus having such a cynical outlook, which sometimes makes it harder for me to go back to things because I'm like, well, I'm just going to come out of this more depressed than I already am, you know?
Right, and we don't need that.
I'm already sad. Don't need to make me more sad.
I gotta say, this is the only Demi I've seen, which I know is a crime.
Okay.
But, you know, we've got another lockdown coming around the corner here in the UK. I'm wondering, when that hits, should I do a pandemic?
Yes!
Full support of this. Yes.
Oh, you already have the hashtag, you have the letterbox tag. I fully support the pandemic.
There's a
watch.
Lot. It's super fun watching his trajectory too, like coming up with Corman in this movie. Mm-hmm. Fun cameos. Mm-hmm. George Romero also cameo in this movie. Mm-hmm. Also fun. But it's so fun to like watch his trajectory because he comes up making these like exploitative, Corman camp trash. And then, like, to go to this movie, like, building to, you know, one of the apex movies of all time. And then, like, having this very bizarre, like, if you make maybe one of the most heralded movies of all time. And then, like, the back half of your career is, like, Philadelphia and, like, remakes. And, like, a quiet indie with, like Rachel Getting Married, like, with Anne Hathaway.
I have seen that one. Sorry. Okay, so I've seen
two.
A good one.
That's very good. Yeah, that is a very good film.
So
I like that movie.
We were so mean to her.
I do find it a bit stressful, though.
It's incredibly stressful.
Yes.
It's so
yes.
It's very.
Imagine that. That's my hot take on Rachel Getting Married. I honestly am a bit stressed watching that movie.
Was a bit stressed.
Yes, very stressful.
Yes, you. Jordan is a Demi expert.
I don't know about expert.
Oh, I'm really glad that we got to talk about him because like you love him so much.
I mean, we'll cover Philadelphia at some point.
Absolutely.
Have to.
Is there any scene?
Will you be able to
feel
find
like
queer subtext in Philadelphia?
I don't know.
Are you saying there's something gay about Philadelphia?
It's honestly a little too obvious. We like to give ourselves more of a challenge.
Yeah, we like to push the barrel. That's actually a good point. Is how do you, because I feel like this movie, if we're talking about like how it was when it was released and the backlash, obviously like there's the huge protests at the Oscars and everything like that. But upon like reading and doing research, it was interesting seeing how much of the backlash was from the trans community versus like the LGBTQ community as the whole. And like specifically like the gay subsect of the community, because I feel like this movie got knocked a lot for being like anti-gay versus anti-trans, which was interesting. And like, I think coming from that, we see Demi like goes to make Philadelphia, which is like a specifically like for the gay community. Like it is for the LGBTQ community at large, but it's like a gay film. And I feel like for serial killers and things like that, like I feel like the plug that we get, and like I like growing up in middle school or whatever, like so many of the jokes would be like gay, like you're like a, you know, I feel like gay was associated with serial killing and like with being like a deviant and an evil,
especially in the aftermath of Jeffrey Dahmer. He just leaves such a big imprint on that as a trope.
Exactly. And so it was fascinating to see at least that dichotomy, because it was like obviously backlash within both, but like a lot of it was specifically like anti-gay versus like anti-trans. Yeah,
I think that the conversation is obviously still evolving, and so it was very
people don't understand the nuances.
At the time, like being trans was like seen as like, okay, so something went wrong with you that made you gay, and then something went wrong with you that made you like double gay, and that's a real problem. These like, gay guys, we gotta fix them. We gotta get them to back to just being gay. That I could maybe handle someday.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the history of queer activism and is enmeshed and intersectional, and like, yeah, gay activism is trans activism, and it's, you know, it was the it's not like we had a like strong trans, like, I don't want to say trans activist because that's what TERFs describe people like me as, but like there wasn't a separate cause at the time,
right?
In a way that is both bad and good, and you know, obviously bad in terms of like, oh, they managed to make it separate when, you know, the ERA needs to be passed and they're like, maybe we could just not cover trans people in it, but yeah, there's something beautiful about the fact that it wasn't just a trans rights issue. It was a gay rights issue.
Yeah. I think that, again, it speaks to like the level of representation on screen and just like how desperate it was.
Right.
And like so much about like the queer community gets like homogenized into one thing, which can be helpful inside the community, but outside of the community can be like super harmful because it's like there's so many different layers and facets. And so yeah, like exactly like you said, it
like
can
understand
be
the nuance of your queerness, whatever it may be, and just not being like, oh, you're
sort of right. The same bubble, like you know, inside the community can be like this amazing like community building thing, and like you said, you have everyone come out in support of something like this, but then on the other hand, it's like it's really not the same thing. Like there's so much more nuance to that. But if this is all that you're seeing on screen, there's just, you know, media representation is, as we all know, an incredibly, incredibly powerful tool, which is why we need as many queer people on screen as possible. Please and thank you. This is just putting that out into the ether. Just saying. Is there any final big scenes you feel like we need to talk about?
What have we not talked about?
I think we actually did a pretty good backdoor job of covering everything.
Yeah.
Love the bug guys.
The bug, the body. Love the bug guys.
I would go on a date with one of the bug guys, and I don't even date dudes, so
they are.
I just want to hear
bug
about
guy.
Bugs. Oh, that was one of the things I was gonna say. I'm so sorry. So I have a fear of butterflies and moths, and I absolutely cannot stand them. And watching this movie again this time and trying to think about it like in a critical lens, I was like, I wonder how much of that came from this movie. But
totally.
Also, I hate the fluttering, the way they flutter near you. I hate it.
I understand.
Do you have
that.
A problem with those scenes? Does it like make your skin crawl? Or
I will say, I watched it in last Christmas. I got given an Oculus VR headset.
Ooh.
Because I'm in a tiny little like studio right now, I was like, you know what? For this movie, I'm gonna load myself into a virtual cinema and watch it on the big screen, quote unquote. Very, very scary.
That's so scary.
That's awesome.
But yeah, the butterflies weren't the worst part of it. It was funny to be like in the night vision goggles scene and have
you're
a headset
like
on my face.
Yeah. That rules kind of.
They need to go back and remaster this for VR so that you can turn your head and
you
Buffalo Bill's head will fall.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, whoa. That's so cool.
That's like my nightmare for like snakes on a plane if it was VR. Like I would be like,
Because you hate snakes.
I do.
You and Indy.
Famously hate snakes, yes.
Yeah.
We all have our animal that we hate.
Of course.
Yeah.
What's yours? Obviously not horses. You love horses.
I actually dislike horses, but I did grow up on a farm and I really hate tomato worms.
You grew up on a farm, so my question would then be, have the lambs stopped screaming?
They have. A long time ago. Luckily, we never had sheep, or I think that this film would actually be like intensely traumatizing to me.
It would maybe make you join the FBI.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. You'd be like,
okay, so now I have a blueprint for my life.
Oh, this film is about me. Cool. Yeah. Awesome. It was much more of like a quaint country farm than like an actual working farm. But we did have a giant garden. And let me just say, tomato worms, which are these worms that hang out on tomatoes and other plants, are fucking gross. And I hate them. And I don't like talking about them because they're nasty.
You want to do a whole tangent on them?
Absolutely not.
You sure? We can.
Yes.
I actually had, when I was invited on this episode, it said, hey, do you want to come on and talk about tomato worms? And so I've been like, why are we talking about science and lambs so much?
Science and lambs, this makes no sense.
We're gonna get to the worms at some point. It's a weird lead into
the silence of the worms.
We knew that we would eventually come to the moss and then we would start talking about animals we were scared of. It's all about the long game, you know, in your head. Yeah,
the thing for me, the scene I think the scariest of all is, I don't even know if it's a horror scene, but when they go to the body and they're taking photos of the woman's body and just seeing her back, like the splays and like the insane close-ups that we get and like pulling the butt, like all of that business skeeves me out. Like body horror like that is just like, because like the skin is still like moist and wet and everything. You're just like, I can't deal with it. It's tough. And like even the way they like take the photos is so cool, because it's like a not a Polaroid, but it's a Polaroid.
It's like a modified Polaroid. Yeah.
It's very cool.
FBI Polaroid. The scene that makes me do the skeeved out business is the nail.
The tomato worms.
Nope. The nail in the well. Yeah. Absolutely not.
People were all talking, like when I was doing the Letterboxd skims and everything, everyone talks about that the nipple scene is the scariest for them, like with the piercing. And I was like, that's not the scary. Like, how is that scary?
That's just trans misogyny. That's I don't want to see a man doing something feminine. And I will say, it's not great. It doesn't feel great when it's happening on screen, but that's just because nipple rings can either be really hot or really gross. And I think that unfortunately falls on the one side. It's a zero on the binary instead of a one.
Of course. Of course.
Very thin, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the movie is spooky. Equal parts spooky and equal parts fascinating. And like we said, super watchable.
Yeah.
Okay, Jordan, do you think we did it?
I think so.
Do you think lambs have stopped screaming?
Did we silence the lambs? Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm so, Avery, I would love for you to check in if you do your pandemic watch and how you feel. Because this movie does feel so out of left field for him. Because like before this, if you can quote me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's Married to the Mob before this. Right. Or...
yeah, I think because that's why he was thinking maybe working with her again. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like the whiplash of that to this is so intense. But would love to know, because it's like he does. It's
so when when I do the pandemic, should I rewatch Silence of the Lambs as part of the viewing order, do you think?
I think you need to.
Evil. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. It is like kind of, said, it's a great movie to revisit. Like,
that's his Everest.
I'm going to have to really clear the schedule, but I'll try to
it's like
it
22 movies.
But it's a long ass filmography. Yeah.
It's so sad though, because this was actually the most heartbreaking part. It's like the end of the commentary with him. He's just like, I'm Jonathan Demme. Thanks for watching the movie. But he's like, he never expected this movie to be as big or anything. He's like, oh, I've kind of always viewed myself as like a journeyman filmmaker. And like all the success this got was like really like humbling. And like people, like it's like he never expected, I think, to be viewed as like a like win best director or like be viewed as such. And he's like thinks of himself so as like a journeyman and just like figuring out what's next. And so by like making this movie, I feel like he was so humbled and almost like overwhelmed by it. Like it felt like it was a lot of pressure. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say the sad thing was that he ended it by saying, I'm Jonathan Demme, and I'm just so glad I'll be making films for another 30, 40, 50 years.
He's like, oh, Demme. I can't wait to see what I have coming next.
It will be interesting when I die to look back and we realize this movie was really a footnote at the beginning of my career rather than the standout in the middle of it.
He's saying, wait till you see Ricky in the Flash.
Oh, I've got that coming.
And that's the end. That's the last one.
Oh, no. Real bad ending. Yeah.
Yikes.
Oof. It's lovely, though, to hear him talk about how humbled he was by the success of this movie, because this movie literally hit, like, every success in
the book. What did it do, Brooke?
Okay, so total... this movie made a lot of money. $130 million domestic, $270 million worldwide on a hot little $20 million budget. So great.
Nice.
I know. It was number one at the box office for 5 weeks straight. It was dropping like 13%, 11%, 15%.
What took it out after?
Let's find out. In March of 1991, it was derailed by Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
No, that's, I'll allow that. That's a great film.
Heroes in the Half Shell, Turtle Power.
There we go.
The Turtles also queer icons.
Oh,
they're removed from society. They live 100%. Literally underground. Yeah.
Oh my God, are we going to cover Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
For sure, yeah. We could do a pitch on it. Like, they have a gay dad, you know?
Okay,
yeah. And they all have sex with each other, right?
Of course.
Anytime they're not in a scene, they're off having sex with each other. Yeah. It's weird.
It was just never mentioned because it's not relevant to the plot. Yeah, but it's definitely there. Okay, great. I'll put that one on the list. This movie played like gangbusters from February through June. And then I think it got re-released at Christmas, basically.
I'm sure.
To get all the Oscar voters. And of course, as we
know, number five of the year.
Three films to win the big five at the Oscars. Best picture, best director, best actor, best actress, best screenplay.
But didn't get... more nom. Well, it did. We got two other noms, but it should have had more.
It should have.
Which is despicable.
Because those were the only five Oscars that it won, and it should have actually won seven.
It should have had cinematography. It should have had score. Mm-hmm. The fact that it didn't have either of those is what's really upsetting to me, because, like, the score is so haunting. It just sticks with you.
I mean, it should have got costume. It has one of the 100% iconic costumes of all time, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Production design. I mean, like, the way that they, like,
I love.
We didn't even talk about Bill's house, but, like, Bill's house is a nightmare trap, and, like, the way
it is impossible to understand the layout of that place. Like,
no,
it's a maze. Yeah,
it's crazy. It's so good because it's like lived in, but it's like you could tell what's like Bill brought to the home, what was there. There's like the fish tank. It's
with
just
the people
like all
in
the
it.
Weird stuff going on. You're like,
the old lady in the bathtub, really underrated creepy shot. Yeah.
Does he not bathe?
I guess not. Or maybe
multiple bathrooms.
Is Bill just like a classic celebrity nowadays, not bathing?
Ha ha.
Got
him.
How thrilled was he when it was like, oh, and there's a well, thank God.
I need
to dig a well.
So useful. It's great.
You see Bill, like, that's the prequel that they're like, all right, we gotta set everything up, just Bill
the lore.
Just 12 hours of building
the capital L lore. Even though I love lore has ruined many franchises, and I will not let it ruin this one.
You love Lord too.
Lord, yes, we also
Lord,
love
Lord.
Lord.
Yes.
And the Lord.
And the Lord. Hey, Jordan.
Hey, Brooke.
Do you want to guess the Letterboxd
rating? I do. This is another embarrassing one in the Inception Book of Secrets, in which I think I have this one already down because I have logged this movie too many times.
Mm-hmm. Avery, you're also
would you like to wager a guess?
Put in a guess.
So I should know this because I logged it so recently, but I'm going to guess 4.6.
Ooh,
very high,
very high, but a good gamble.
It's a great movie.
It's a great movie. I think it's a 4.3.
It's a 4.3.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's embarrassing because, like, there are tough ones, but, like, I'll go back, like, ones that I log a lot. Like, I'll just go back and, like, read comments and skim. So, like, it's this, Inception, Jennifer's
Body.
That's
the best comment section on the internet. It's incredible.
It
is. Only good stuff.
Yeah.
We love Letterboxd because I feel like Letterboxd is what the people actually think. It's
democracy.
Like, it's more, no, but it's more fringy than like Rotten Tomatoes. Like, I feel Letterboxd tells you more about what queer people are like watching and
but
enjoying.
But sometimes though, like Jennifer's Body has like a whatever the
like
average
three,
is. It's like you
whatever.
Look at it and it's just like across the board a mess.
Yeah.
You know?
I love Letterboxd a lot. I've been a paid member for a long time.
We love to see it.
And it's a tricky site though, because it can be really susceptible to cultural waves and like the moments take on a movie. And also like, yeah, I remember seeing some meme that was like the different types of Letterboxd reviewers. And like, there's like the, yeah, I live in LA, I study film, I leave a pithy one line comment that's kind of a joke instead
that's
of
us.
A review. And it's, yeah, it's like, I did that a lot as well because I was very influenced by your like, your Brad Pitts, your Demi Adejuyibes, like that. Some of Demi's reviews are often longer, but he has some very funny, your Fran Hoffner's like, some of the best one line reviews in the game. And yeah, so every time I go to write a review now, I'm like, oh, I don't want to do just the joke, but also like my thoughts aren't good enough to...
It's so hard.
Yeah, I'm like, nobody wants to read what I'm thinking, but maybe they'll like this little pithy one-liner.
Right. Yeah.
Like, nobody wants to know what I actually think about
like, I'm
movie.
Waiting for that movie that makes me want to write, like, that five-page, essay that some of them are, where, like, you just write an expose on the film.
I watched Paul Verhoeven's Elle today, and I go to write the review, and I'm just like, oh, this is way too complex to write a review. I just want to write like, yeah, but that video game they're making sucks, right? But then I look at the reviews and everyone has left that. So I was just like, okay, I'll just do the star. No text.
Yeah. Isabelle Huppert top me. Like, that's
Oh my God. Isabelle Huppert. Can we do a brief tangent? I know we've gone long already.
Oh, no.
No. Isabelle Huppert tangent.
Absolutely. Always.
So the first time I saw, I was 17. I had a girl. I had a crush on a girl at school. And she recommended I watch the Adrian Brody film, The Pianist.
Oh, my.
And I go on play.com, which was where I got DVDs at the time. And I'm like, I don't see The Pianist here, which, of course not. It had just come out in the cinemas. It wasn't on DVD yet. But I see La Pianiste. Is that what she means? So I order that. It's the French DVD version of The Piano Teacher with Isabelle Huppert. And I sit down thinking like, all right, this girl recommended to me, so I'm sure it's going to be a good film. And it is a very good film, but I just have my mind blown by this Hanukkah movie where she is just one of the most fucked up women that's ever been put on screen. And
that's
then, like,
so
yeah,
amazing.
The next year I see I Heart Huckabees. She's incredible in that. I buy like, I track down a copy of this film, Ma Mère, which is a French movie about a mother and a son. So, and it stars Isabelle Huppert. So guess where it's going?
I wonder.
One of the greatest actresses of all time, right?
She's so
good. Absolutely.
Incredible.
Please top me. Or even just like run into me at a store and I accidentally bump into you and give me a withering look. That's
exactly
all I want from Isabelle Huppert.
Gently insult me.
You wish you were Chloe Grace Moretz in the hit film
Greta. Oh, man. Yeah.
Wild movie.
Wow.
Wild film.
Wow.
I love that. I'm obsessed.
That's really good.
Also,
that's
good on you for not giving money to Roman Polanski.
Yeah.
Oh,
the pianist,
yeah. No,
yeah.
Sure. So there we go. Okay.
Wow.
We silenced
the lamps. We did. We silenced them.
All of that good stuff.
We Anton Chigurh'd them.
Do you want to go around and give our QQ ratings?
Let's do it.
Okay, cool. Let's see. Prior to reading Brian Fuller's lovely Rolling Stone interview, I was like, I don't really know what if I can like positively rate this on the QQ. Like, I don't know what to do, but I think that like being able to look at this film in sort of like the duality of the queer aspects with the Buffalo Bill of it all, but then also like the Hannibal Clarice of it all, sort of like, I think like helped me look at this film in a new way that is like very exciting. I'm obviously a massive Hannibal fan, and like I know that show is so inspired by this film, as is like, you know, every other piece of media ever made.
Brian Fuller, come on the show.
We love you. And so I feel like it's kind of boring, but I think I just want to go down the middle and give it like a 2.5 because I feel like it's doing a lot of good stuff in certain areas and a lot of bad stuff in other areas. And it's a tricky movie, like we said right at the beginning. But I love this movie, clearly. Yeah, that's all I have to say. How about you, Jordan? What are you thinking?
Fuck, this is a tough one.
Right? It's hard. Really,
yeah, it's tricky. I think I'm going to go a little lower.
Okay.
I think I'm going to go with that's a two. Fine. I think that's just because I think like the legacy is really tricky with this movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the bad that came from it is really hard to overlook. And like, as we were saying, like when you cut to Bill, it's just really bad. But Jodie Foster's there, and Jodie Foster is a queer icon. And I really love the Brian Fuller read, as you were saying. But yeah, I mean, I think that this movie exists and it can be a perfect movie. I view it, you know, five stars, whatever. But it's like we have to sort of take into account sort of the reckoning that this movie left. And I think that Demi being able to realize that and then to make Philadelphia after this, I think is a good sort of attempt at a reparation.
Mm-hmm.
And like sort of recognizing that it was flawed, I think is important. And you don't really see, I think, a lot of directors actually actively make that step,
right?
Which I think it would have been very easy for a lot of white cis men, heterosexual,
like
just
Demi.
To be like, oh, whatever, like I made a mistake, let me go make like another movie. But instead to like actively be like, no, I'm going to like make this movie about the AIDS crisis, I think is interesting. So yeah, so that's sort of my read. I think I'm gonna go with a two.
Okay. Avery, do you
I think coming in I was like, yeah, it's like a minus 2.5 because of the Buffalo Bill stuff.
Yeah.
And then Jodie being in it gives it two stars. The relationship between her and Hannibal gives it another 1.5 stars. So I will end up with 1 star overall.
That's pretty, yeah.
I think that's a solid nuanced place to be.
Yeah. No, I like it. I love the negative stars are definitely deserved.
Yes.
I think.
Yep.
It's a difficult film, but I like the idea that this is like a 5-star film and also a 1-star film at the same time.
Yes.
And that like, it's just one of those movies that's like so undeniable as a piece of cinema that like people are willing to like have the conversations and like actually talk about like the recontextualizing of it and sort of like the legacy, where so much of these types of films are either just like sort of pushed to the side and like you don't really get to like reckon with like how representation has changed. And it's just really nice because as I think we all agree, this film is a masterclass in so many ways. It's great.
I just hope
really
like
we got to talk about it.
I think it's interesting, and I think that like I think as we're going, representation will get better. I think you look at like sort of what has happened in the past with trans representation with from like Hillary Swank, Jared Leto, Eddie Redmayne, like everything like those and how bad it was. And I think that we as a society are starting to recognize how flawed those portrayals were and how bad they were and damaging. And like, hopefully like the representation in like a drama movie and things like that will start to like come around to be actually like positive. And even if it's like a movie that's trying to portray it as a positive light, recognizing that it's like there are certain steps you have to take to not be damaging to a community, that you actually have to do these things that are important.
Yeah
And like casting matters. So
casting matters for sure.
I hope we can get to a point where, you know, now we've got a few trans actresses and like big names. I hope we can get to a point where we have famous trans actresses who can act well. I think that's the important next step. But, you know, we've got some people on screen right now and they're certainly saying the words. We just need to.
The talent.
That's my spicy take on Laverne Cox and Jamie Clayton right there.
I think that's a good spicy take.
You're cooking the brain and you're sprinkling a little of your spice.
There you go. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the conversation evolves. Avery, thank you so much for being here. You are so amazing. I'm very honored. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's so exciting to be on here. And it was such a good time. What a lovely discussion.
So glad. You are great. And if people want to see more of you and your work, where should they go to find you?
They should go to twitter.com/aedison. I have been on there since 2007. It has ruined my brain. I can only communicate with the outside world through Twitter. And I'm pretty good at it. I don't post too much. I won't flood your feed. But when I do post, it'll either be really funny or really smart or both.
Correct.
And also, I'm posting a lot of selfies lately because I'm trying to recover my self-esteem and appreciation of my own physical body. So, yeah, tune in for those as well. Tune in to my Twitter.
I love it.
May I just say, very good selfies. Yes.
Oh, thank you very much.
We
thank
support.
You.
Very good.
And also, no. The book.
The book.
We stand.
Oh, that's never coming.
unless.
But tell you what, about like maybe 7 years ago, I wrote a series of essays about being trans, because every trans person does eventually, for a website called the Bygone Bureau, which is now a bygone website, sadly. But then when I wrapped up those essays, I then published them, just self-published them in an ebook with a bunch of like annotations and commentary.
Awesome.
So it's not like full book size, but it's, you know, it's fairly lengthy. And if you're interested in trans people or just me and my brain in general, it's like, it's free. I used to charge $10 for it, but now it's free. You can just go to avereddison.com/rightbodywrongjunk. And, yeah, it's there for free in like any format you might want to read it in.
Amazing.
That's amazing. Yeah. We'll link it in our description and all of the other good stuff. So, yeah. Give it a
Thanks.
Click if no matter what you're it. Listening to. That sounds awesome. I will definitely be looking it up immediately after we end this recording. We're not as exciting, but
we
are
also
on Twitter.
Brain dead on Twitter.
Suffering from brain rot. I'm at Brooke P. Solomon.
Jordan H. Gus.
And we're together at Queer Quadrant. And you can find this podcast on Spotify and on Apple and wherever else you happen to get your podcasts. You can drop us a rate. That would be so cool.
Help us eat our way up the charts.
Yes, absolutely.
Help us cook we're gonna cook some other podcasters to find our that's what it is there we go
okay
we are the Hannibals. We're eating other podcasts to climb our way up the charts
and like to gain their power.
Yeah
Okay, great.
Okay, cool. That's not gonna backfire at all.
You can drop us a rate, or you can drop us a review, or you can drop us a subscribe. That would be great. You can also tweet at us and tell us what you think about this movie. You can yell at me about NBC Hannibal. I would be honored. And let us know also what you would like us to cover in the future.
And so, Brooke, what are we covering next week?
So I'm actually surprised I didn't mention this at the top of the episode, but it is spooky season here on the Queer Quadrant.
Ooh.
And this month we are highlighting a whole month of films with trans and or non-binary centric themes, as you can tell from this episode. So next week, for a complete departure from this film, we are talking about Seed of Chucky.
Woo. Also a horror movie. There's some stabbing.
There is a lot of slashing.
Yes.
And let me just tell you, it's already in the can, and it is
Great
episode.
Yes.
I'm very excited for everyone to hear it.
We should mention the plant and payoff, as we had said before.
Yes. Previous guest, Arden Yerskis, one of our favorite people, is returning to the show to cash in on their incredible pitch to cover this movie.
Yep.
And let me just say, it pays out a little bit like a slot machine.
Like a stab machine.
It's awesome. So tune in next week for that.
Very good. And Brooke, do you have anything you would like to leave our audience with?
I mean, I think there's only one option, Jordan. We have to go because we're having an old friend for dinner.
We are.